Our guest this evening is Scott Bradley. I'll give a little bit of Scott's background. He's married with 5 children and 4 grandchildren. He's employed at Utah State University as Director of Telecommunications. His undergraduate education is in the field of political science. He has a master's degree in public administration. And he's an avid student for approximately 30 years in political foundations of the United States, its history, and the writings of the founding fathers of the nation. He's the founder of the Constitutional Commemoration Foundation on educational organizations committed to the preservation of the principles upon which the nation was established. I'm reading my own writing here, that's the problem. He began and continues to present the annual Cache Valley commemoration of the signing of the United States Constitution during the week of 17 September. He is the author of the pageant A Day to Remember, which is performed each year as part of the Cache Valley commemoration of the signing of the United States Constitution. He loves to help young and old alike gain an appreciation for our wonderful heritage of liberty. He's a former member of the Boy Scouts of America Trapper Trails Council Executive Board. Those of you who've listened to the radio have probably heard him from time to time. That's when I first heard him, several years ago. So I'd like to introduce our guest speaker for tonight, Scott Bradley.
Well, thank you all for being here. This has kind of taken on a life of its own, this whole gathering tonight, I think. When I was first initially contacted, it was to maybe meet with a little group of about 20 people in a house and share an idea or two. And it's grown a little bit, and there's been probably some variations of maybe why people are here. I hope you're all here to learn about some of the founding principles of the nation, but you need to understand that they will be from a perspective of the LDS faith. And if you haven't got that understanding already, I want you to understand that up front. I'm going to use LDS scripture a lot. Words of men that those that are involved in the LDS faith would consider men that were called of God in these days to perform labors in regards to the restoration of the kingdom and a lot of the other things that are going on here. Now, even if you're not of the LDS faith, but if you love the Constitution, I think you'll be interested in this. And if you're not a member of the LDS faith, perhaps you could kind of keep a little bit of a open mind and say, you know what, those guys believe an awful lot like I do, if you believe in saving the Constitution in the last days. And you'll maybe say, you know, golly, I don't know why these Mormons aren't a little bit more agitated about what's going on after you hear what everybody said from Joseph Smith forward in these days. And so I appreciate very much the prayer. Oh, let me say one other thing real quickly. Some of you have been to some talks I've given that have been very, very formal and very much a lecture and a and when we're done and we walk out and there's nothing more to be said or done. And it's a little bit dangerous for me to say what I'm going to say right now, but I would like to have you feel comfortable enough if we're on a side path or someplace that we're going with a discussion and you say, golly, I'd like to know more. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? If you've got any more information, you know, raise your hand and let's talk about it. Like, for example, if I said, I've got a lot of information about things that have been said by those that have led the LDS Church in regards to war. And the scriptures say much about it. And, you know, you may go, whoa, we're involved in one of those things. Maybe I'd like to hear that. And so there's a lot of different paths we can take tonight. And consequently, I'm going to be flexible in how we go about it. And I bought down, none of this stuff's for sale, by the way. Okay, so don't come up and want to borrow or buy one of the books. I do have some handouts we'd like to give you if you're interested. I've got a little timeline that I did I was out camping. I apologize, it's done in my handwriting, but I did copy it afterwards. It's a timeline of the Book of Mormon. And I hope we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about why I think that's important in today's work. I've got a few statements that have been made by, you know, scripturally and Latter-day prophets in regards to the Constitution. And I've got a handout. Many of you have probably got this book, The Constitution, the Heavenly Banner. Have any of you seen or read this book? If you haven't, it's a marvelous read, and you need to have it. I've got it. Ezra Taft Benson. So he gave this 99 years less one day after the Constitution was signed. I don't know, 199 years. He's a little older than that. I mean, a little more distant. But anyway, 199 years, and then it was published as this little book, and we've got it down to two pages front and back. And it's a marvelous read about the Constitution and his perspective, Constitution, the Heavenly Banner, and it's worth having in your home, I think. So we made enough copies, I think, for... I hope we've got enough for everybody here. If not, we'll at least just get one for every family. But I think I've got 100 copies or more, so we probably should be okay. A couple other ground rules that I thought I would hope that we could abide by. One of them is found in Doctrine and Covenants, section 42. And it says, if ye receive not the Spirit, ye shall not teach. And the prayer suggested that that would be an important thing to have. And I concur, and hopefully we'll be able to do that. And then in the 50th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, it says, doth he preach it by the Spirit of truth or some other way? And if it be by some other way, it is not of God. And again, he that receiveth the word of truth, doth he receive it by the Spirit of truth or some other way? And if it be some other way, it is not of God. Therefore, why is it that ye cannot understand and know that he that receiveth the word by the Spirit of truth receiveth it as it is preached by the Spirit of truth? Wherefore, he that preacheth and he that receiveth understand one another, and both are edified and rejoice together. I hope we would have that kind of feeling here tonight. And then there's another little thing out of the scriptures, and I hopefully, maybe, I don't know, somebody might have even actually brought their scriptures, or maybe if they did, you can follow along. But in the 11th chapter of 3rd Nephi, when the Savior had appeared among the peoples of this nation, of this world, this part of the world, he says, for verily, verily, I say unto you, he that hath the spirit of contention is not of me, but is of the devil, who is the father of contention, and he stirreth up the hearts of men to contend with anger one with another. Behold, this is not my doctrine, to stir up the hearts of men with anger one with another against another, but this is my doctrine, that such things should be done away. So hopefully we will be able to have that kind of feeling here tonight as we meet and maybe talk about some of these things that are pretty important, in my opinion, and I think you'll come to understand that the prophets have felt that same way. I also would like you to understand something that... I agree with you. A lot of time, in fact, I'll read you a scripture about this. It's kind of a fun scripture. it's in the second chapter of Alma. And it has to do with I'll read the verse 5. It says, and it came to pass that the people assembled themselves together throughout all the land, every man according to his mind, whether it were for or against Amlici in separate bodies, having much dispute and wonderful contentions one with another. So they talked about them vigorously, enthusiastically. And there are many today who would, I think, have us believe that the prophets have discouraged us from being able to seek after the knowledge in this particular venue that we're looking at tonight, this idea of the Constitution and proper government. And nothing could be farther from the truth. And let me just read you just something that Ezra Taft Benson said back in 1968, and then I'll give you a couple of... read out of a couple of proclamations that were sent out by the First Presidency in support of exactly what you're doing tonight, trying to seek after an understanding of proper government. But Ezra Taft Benson, back in 1968, he gave a great talk called The Proper Role of Government. It was given before the Utah Forum, not Eagle Forum, it was before Eagle Forum, but Utah Forum, and then he gave it later in General Conference. And then he talks about, you know, what do you think about all these issues that are out there today? And that's how he begins his talk. And he says, such an approach, meaning what do you think about them, to vital political questions of the day can only lead to public confusion and legislative chaos. Decisions of this nature should be based upon and measured against certain basic principles regarding the proper role of government. If principles are correct, then they can be applied to any specific proposal with confidence. And quite frankly, the principles of proper government are quite simple. The Constitution can be read and understood by, well, maybe not all 10th graders now, but anybody that's gone through 10th grade should be able to. It's not something you need a Philadelphia lawyer there to interpret for you. It's plain, simple English. The words have meanings and they may be known. The prophets have said statements just as plainly and even more so, in my opinion, in regards to these matters. So people that try and steer us away from this, I think, are closing their mind to something that has been very energetically and enthusiastically and eloquently and powerfully, and I don't know how many other adjectives I can put on it, fostered by those that have led the Latter-day Saint Church. I'm going to quote from a few different things. This little book here is something I put together almost 10 years ago. The title you may not like, but maybe you'll find a little humor in it. I don't know. It's called LDS Pronouncements Regarding Socialism, Communism, Fascism, Welfare Statism, and Other Collectivist Forms of Satan's Plan. 10 years ago, I thought, you know, there's sure a lot of people in the church that seem to think that those forms of government have some acceptance to the Lord. And many of those have embraced them, whether we know it or not. And it's, I thought, well, golly, you know, I hold these things very passionately, how I feel about this. Maybe, what if I was wrong? Whew, that wouldn't be good. So I thought, what I'm going to do is try and do a comprehensive review of Latter-day pronouncements, beginning with Joseph Smith coming forward in regards to these other forms of government. And I took an extended period of time. I don't remember how long it was, but it was weeks and weeks. And I was very intensively immersed in seeking anything that was said that would lend credence to the idea that any of those forms of government were acceptable to God. And I boiled it down to about 150 pages because I figured nobody would ever want to read anything more than that anyway. But there isn't a shred of evidence in any of the research that I was able to do. And I went through as many archives and databases and old books and everything that I could find in regards to the subject matter. And there wasn't anything that would lead credence to the idea that the socialistic perspective was one that God endorsed. Quite to the contrary, it's been called Satan's counterfeit in so many ways to all the different things that are properly given to us by the inspiration of God and through the founding fathers. And this concept of agency goes back to the premortal existence, and that's kind of what this proper government's all about, is being able to help us exercise our agency properly. Well, let me just read you something that was put out by David O. McKay back in 1966 in regards to what you're doing here. In this connection, we are continually being asked to give our opinion regarding various patriotic groups or individuals who are fighting communism and speaking up for freedom. Our immediate concern, however, is not with parties, groups, or persons, but with principles. We therefore commend and encourage every person and every group who is sincerely seeking to study constitutional principles and awaken a sleeping and apathetic people to the alarming conditions that are rapidly advancing upon us. We wish all of our citizens throughout the land were participating in some type of organized self-education in order that they could better appreciate what is happening and know what they can do about it. So, and this was given in General Conference, by the way. Well, golly, that was a long time ago. Probably half the people in this room weren't even born. Well, this is another little compilation. Well, some of you guys are older, okay? I can tell that. The words of President Ezra Taft Benson. Some of you have maybe even seen a little document like this. Basically, this little book was stuff that came out of President Benson while he was the prophet. And here's a little letter that was sent out over the signature of all the first presidency, Ezra Taft Benson, Gordon B. Hinckley, and Thomas Monson. And it's the 15th of January, 1987. I'm not going to read you the whole letter, but I'll read you just some little segments of it. We encourage Latter-day Saints throughout the nation to familiarize themselves with the Constitution. They should focus attention on it by reading and studying it. They should ponder the blessings that come through it. They should recommit themselves to its principles and be prepared to defend it and the freedom it provides. And by the way, it gives a notation there of Doctrine and Covenants 109:54, and we're going to read that in just a minute. Because that was the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple that came out in. But let me go on for a second. Citizens of this nation are free, of course, to participate in efforts designed to warn of the threat of any force or power, theory, or principle that would deprive them of their freedom or the individual liberties vouchsafed by the Constitution. Because some Americans have not kept faith with our founding fathers, the Constitution faces severe challenges. Those who do not prize individual freedom are trying to erode its great principles. We believe the Constitution will stand, but it will take the efforts of patriotic and dedicated Americans to uphold it. President John Adams, our nation's second president, offered a special insight into the Constitution when he said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Thus, we as Latter-day Saints must be vigilant in doing our part to prepare the Constitution, protect the Constitution and safeguard the way of life it makes." So, as recently as 1987, we were admonished to meet together as groups and understand and better study the Constitution. So I think it's not out of line at all to try and do what's happening tonight. Yes, sir. That was a letter of the first presidency sent out in January of 1987, which was the beginning of the bicentennial year that the Constitution was signed in. Okay, and that was to be read across the pulpit in sacrament meetings. So, you know, it's got their signatures on it. I guess they meant what they said. Well, we have a great challenging time we live in. There are many voices that call us low here and others low there. What is to be done? And I think that if we're willing to sit down and study and discover, we'll find that there is a path that has been set. It's never been countermanded, never been contradicted, we've never been told to set it aside. It's quiet now, though. Some of you may be frustrated with that, and there may be some reasons for that, and we may want to talk about that at some point, because I don't know for sure why it's so quiet. But I do think that there's some things that we could maybe suppose. Yes, ma'am? Oh, she's waving at her friends. Well, one other thing I think I wanted to say before we got too far into this was that one of the things that I do this because I love it. I love the principles. I want to preserve them. I would love to have my grandchildren be able to grow up in a land that's free so that they can exercise their agency, so they can worship their God, so they can support themselves, so they can teach and learn wonderful principles and live by them. Right now, my grandchildren don't have a clue as to what's at stake. And somebody's got to do this. That's why I am so dedicated to this. One of the reasons, anyway. I love the principles, and even if I didn't have grandchildren, I'd be doing it. But I guess you could say it's not really a motto, it's a credo or something to live by. The last verse of the 60th chapter of Alma is something that Captain Moroni wrote. He wrote to Pehoran and was kind of chewing him out about sitting on his throne in his thoughtless stupor. You remember that part, don't you? And he says, "I seek not for power, but to pull it down. I seek not for the honor of the world, but for the glory of my God and the freedom and welfare of my country." And I think that's my motivation. I really, truly desire the freedom and welfare of my country. We're all brothers and sisters. This land is a great land. It's a beacon of hope to nations across the world. And if we can't hold on to what we've got, it's going to be a great disappointment to others. And I truly believe that by keeping the principles of freedom here, we're going to allow this nation to continue for some period of time, at least, to be a platform from which the message of truth and the hope of freedom can be taken to the rest of the world. So those are some of my motivations. And some people say, well, we're going to try and hang on and maybe we'll get involved sometime when it's popular or something like that. Let me just read you something that Ezra Taft Benson said. "Many of us are here today because our forefathers loved truth enough that they fought at Valley Forge or crossed the plains in spite of the price it cost them or their families. We had better take our small pain now than our greater loss later. There were souls who wished afterwards that they had stood and fought with Washington and the Founding Fathers, but they waited too long. They passed up eternal glory. There has never been a greater time than now to stand up against entrenched evil. And while the Gentiles established the Constitution, we have a divine mandate to preserve it. But unfortunately, today, in this freedom struggle, many Gentiles are showing greater wisdom than in their generation than the children of light. So it's an indictment against many of us that have, you know, some of our forefathers. I had forefathers that were on the Mayflower. I had them in the Revolutionary conflict. I had them, well, one of my ancestors was with John Taylor up in Canada when Parley P. Pratt showed up and taught them the gospel. Another one, his name was George Washington Bradley, by the way. I don't know if that means anything to you. His brother's name was Thomas Jefferson Bradley, by the way. And his wife's name was Betsy. So, I mean, there's no patriotic genes here. But at any rate, George Washington Bradley was at Nauvoo, and he was driven out of Nauvoo in 1846. His son, Hiram Moroni Bradley, was born in winter quarters in 1847 as they came west. He's my direct ancestor. In fact, there was everybody after him that was the firstborn son was named Hiram, and my mother wouldn't hear of it, so I'm named Scott. But that was the heritage. I could have been about the sixth in a row or something like that. Anyway, but my mom didn't want that, so it was, I think, the fifth. But anyway, what marvelous people these were. They paid such a price. And for us to just take it so carelessly and let it slip through our fingers, I think, is an indictment against us. We need to step up and do something. As President Benson said, you know what? Some people waited too long to step up and be part of this thing that George Washington was involved in. I hope that we'll be involved right from, if we're not already, we'll begin tonight to be involved in it. Well, a lot of these things I brought, in fact, I'm not sure quite how to do this, but does anybody not have a constitution that would like one? Maybe I can have some help here with some people distributing constitutions. Let's start out with these if they don't have. Maybe most everybody has some. I don't know. And then we'll give out these other things as we go. But it's interesting to me that if you go to the 12th Article of Faith, we believe in being subject to kings, rulers, presidents, magistrates, and obeying, not understanding, sustain the law. Any primary child could tell you that. Well, obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law. What does that mean? What does that mean? And I hope when we get done tonight, we'll have a pretty firm understanding about what that means. The 134th section of the Doctrine and Covenants says, "We believe that governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man, and that he holds men accountable for their acts in relation to them, both in making laws and administering them for the good and safety of society." Governments were instituted of God. Well, does that mean? Oh, that's the first verse of the 134th section. Well, does that mean that all governments were instituted of God? Some people believe that. Some people within the church say the Scripture says government was instituted of God. Now, they forget about this of benefit for man. How many governments have been run by individuals that names are despicable? Well, Pol Pot, Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, Mao Zedong. Castro, Chavez. I mean, I don't know. You could go on and on and on with the list. Were their governments instituted of God? Or are they anomalies that basically have taken something that God gave to us in order that we might have benefit, and they've polluted it? Well, it's comforting that a Latter-day Prophet has declared the truth in this matter. Here's what Joseph Fielding Smith said. It should not be understood that because Oliver Cowdery declared and the Church has approved the statement in this article, Doctrine and Covenants, section 34, that we believe that governments are instituted of God for the benefit of man, that therefore God has been the author of every government upon the earth. He is the author of government, for government prevails throughout the universe. But some of the despotic governments have been far from the governments established or instituted by the hand of God. In the beginning, as previously stated, government was instituted for the benefit of man, but man, in his rebellious nature, turned from that government given by the Almighty to organizations of his own. And President Hinckley, in a more recent time, in 1997, said, "The wars in which this nation has been involved during this, the most bloody century of all time, have resulted from the greed, the avarice, the arrogance, the conceit, and egotism of men in power, who sought to enslave and exercise dominion over others. Their very attitude has been totally incompetent with the recognition of the Almighty to whom each of us is accountable." So many of you know, and I'm sure that if you thought about it for a second, you'd understand that in the very beginning that we have record of anyway, in the premortal existence, and you read about this in Moses chapter 4, there was a council that was held, and of course you read about it in Abraham chapter 3 too, but in that council it says that Satan sought to destroy the agency of man. Now that agency had been declared by God and was and is continually supported by him as an eternal principle. And I wish there was time to really spend on this thing of agency, but it's absolutely essential for us to be able to fulfill the purposes for which we're on earth. Satan has found that one of the best ways to destroy mankind's agency is through the exercise of the ultimate power on earth called government. Consequently, he has sought throughout the ages to gain full control of government, because government is what? Not eloquence, not reason, but force. Okay, you've heard the saying attributed to George Washington. And so if it is force and it becomes kind of the ultimate force in mortality, you can see why Satan would try to achieve predominance over it, because then he can gain control over everybody's, all the things you need in order to have your agency. You need to have a knowledge of the truth. He can control that. He can control your life and even your health. He can control whether or not you have private property. And private property is an absolutely essential element of agency. Because, and you can read about this in the Federalist Papers if you want sometime, and even somebody as obtuse as Alexander Hamilton was able to understand that if you control a man's substance, you control the man. Okay? All of those things can be controlled by government. And so Satan has sought so diligently to do that. Well, like I say, I wish we could spend more time on this, but so what form of government does God really endorse? Well, if you want to go on to the second verse of the 134th section, you can read, "We believe that no government can exist in peace except such laws are framed and held inviolate as will secure to each individual the free exercise of conscience, the right and control of property, and the protection of life." So conscience and your ability to exercise within that element that you've got, property. And a lot of people today say, what is property? I mean, who cares? Who cares if the government owns it? Who cares if you can't do your own property? Of course, most of the people in this room would disagree with that, I'm sure. But the fact of the matter is, it's a recognition there that you need to be able to have property in order to sustain your family and care for the things that you, that in just making sure that they can live. And of course, protecting life. Verse 5, it says, "We believe that all men are bound to sustain and uphold the respective governments in which they reside," now get this, "while protected in their inherent and inalienable rights by the laws of such governments." Okay, well, what are those inherent and inalienable rights? We'll go back to verse 2 if you want to read that. You need to be able to have exercise your conscience, to have private property, and to be able to keep your life. And governments have been known to destroy all of those things. Well, so if we are to obey, honor, and sustain the laws, the 12th article of faith says, what is the law? Well, we're going to review a number of things the prophets have said fairly quickly, and I'm taking much more time with this introduction thing than I was going to, and we may not even get done with much of what I prepared tonight, but I guess that's fine. In order to go over these, I'd like everybody to maybe have a handout, so if I could have some help. And in fact, this handout that I'm giving, I didn't have enough room to get all of the stuff on that I wanted to, so I've abbreviated a little bit. Not abbreviated, but I haven't put as many verses in as I would have liked to. But let's look at a few scriptures. And just so we can get... Now, by the way, what I'm going to tell you now, are there any attorneys here? Are you? Okay. Have you heard the term incorporated by reference? It's something we use when I want to make sure, for example, I'm a technologist, okay, I sometimes have some technical specification I want to include in something I've provided to a vendor. And so by reference, I incorporate that technical specification, so I don't have to write the whole thing in there. You know, some technical specifications are pretty thick, and I don't want to write that in there. So I say I'm incorporating this technical specification by reference, meaning you've got to go out and get that reference and read it and say, oh, I've got to comply with these things. When we get done with this little review, I hope you'll kind of have the feeling like I do that the Constitution of the United States is incorporated by reference into LDS Scripture. That's a pretty powerful statement. If we really believe that, that's a pretty amazing thing. Well, in fact, you're going to see here in a minute something. I mean, I just took one little tiny quote from Ezra Taft Benson. We could take hundreds, literally, from him. But let's go. Back in August of 1833, in Doctrine and Covenants, Section 98, verses 4 through 7, that's only I'm going to read you. I'm going to want to go through 11, actually. Let me read it 4 through 11 out of my scriptures. And you've only got part of this on yours, but I just didn't have enough room to get it on one page. And now verily I say unto you concerning the laws of the land, it is my will that my people should observe to do all things whatsoever I command them. So he's saying, listen up, guys, I'm going to tell you to do something. Okay. And that the law of the land, which is constitutional, supporting the principle of freedom and maintaining the rights and privileges, belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me. Therefore, I, the Lord, justify you and your brethren of my church in befriending that law which is the constitutional law of the land. And as pertaining to law of man, whatsoever is more or less than this cometh of evil. Wait a minute. What's more or less than this is wrong then. Okay? So he's saying, you guys are okay. Obey the constitutional law of the land, you'll be fine. Okay, and whatever's more or less than that is cometh of evil. And I, the Lord, make you free. Therefore you are free indeed, and the law also maketh you free. Nevertheless, when the wicked rule, the people mourn. Okay, now, this next verse, which you don't have in front of you, is important. It's verse 10. Listen what he says in verse 10 about those that we should choose and elect. Wherefore, honest men... Wise men and wise men should be sought for diligently, and good men, and then he says wise again, wise men ye should observe to uphold, otherwise whatsoever is less than these cometh of evil. So honest and wise, and good and wise. Wise is mentioned twice. Now, as I've thought about that, and I spend a lot of time thinking, because, well, maybe I spend too much time thinking, but the fact of the matter is, this is the Lord's charge on how we should select those that are to lead us. So they should be honest. Now, I believe that people can honestly be wrong. Okay? It happens all the time. And I think that they can be good in their hearts. You know, you can be pretty good. But if you're not wise in following the plan the Lord has set, then there's a problem. See, we have plenty of good and honest people. Some of the politicians aren't as good or honest as we'd like, but there are some, honestly. I mean, I don't want to slam all the politicians, because so many are people honestly just trying to do the best they can. But if they aren't wise enough to follow the plan that the Lord has set forth, then we got a problem. And it says, actually, whatsoever is less than these cometh of evil. Okay? So, there were many people that followed Hitler honestly. They really and truly believed that he had the plan. There were many that followed Mao Zedong. But he was wrong. And what those men did was so destructive. It was destructive of human life, of families, of everything we hold dear, including the principles of righteousness in the gospel. Well, so it's a problem unless we can say we can find those that we want to have to lead us that are truly wise, and that wisdom comes from following the Lord's plan. And he says, whatsoever is more or less than the Constitution cometh of evil, so that's an endorsement. But verse 11, which you don't have in front of you, by the way, unless you got your scriptures, gives a very interesting little statement here. And I give unto you a commandment that ye shall forsake all evil and cleave unto all good, that ye shall live by every word which proceedeth forth out of the mouth of God. Live by every word which proceedeth forth out of the mouth of God. Now, didn't he just say the Constitution, anything more or less than this cometh of evil? And I know I'm probably being too elementary for everybody here, but we need to think about that. He says that live by every word that proceedeth forth from the mouth of God in a number of places in the Scriptures, not the least of which is one in section 84, where he reviews the oath and covenant of the priesthood. He tells us the oath and covenant of the priesthood, and then he says, ye shall live by every word that proceedeth forth from the mouth of God. And I find it personally very fascinating that here we have this priesthood that is of such great importance in all eternity has that after it, and the Constitution endorsement has that after it too. I think, whoa, there's a correlation there. We're going to see a Joseph Smith statement here in just a minute after we read a few scriptures that will kind of reinforce that idea of the associations between things. Let's go over to the 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Get so many papers. I needed an extra table here, and the podium is not even big enough for everything I've got. So, this was in December of 1833 that the 101st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, and many of you probably have these memorized and everything. Verse 77 begins, according to the laws and constitution of the people which I have suffered to be established should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh according to just and holy principles, that every man may act in doctrine and principle pertaining to futurity according to the moral agency which I have given unto them, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. And by the way, I'm not going to spend any time on this tonight. Go home and read the 29th section or chapter of Mosiah. And he gives a marvelous dissertation there about the great importance of having freedom so that you will be accountable for your own sins and you'll be able to be the one that chooses the path you want. And it's a very wonderful thing when that constitutional republic is being set up in the Americas. Okay, verse 79. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another. And for this purpose have I established the constitution of this land by the hands of wise men, whom I raised up unto this very purpose and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. So, these guys... Yes, sir? I was going to say, these... Okay. These guys... the founding fathers of the United States of America were incredible men. In fact, in a minute, we're going to have a little statement by Gordon B. Hinckley about them. And in another little book that I've got up here, I brought a lot of little books. Because if you don't believe there's stuff that you can't find substantial evidence of what I'm telling you about, I want you to be able to go get these books. Don't take mine. Some of them are hard to get now. But a lot of them are recommended in General Conference. But this little book is called This Nation Shall Endure. And in this little book... Well, I'll just read you what Ezra Taft Benson said about the men that founded this nation. He said, President George Washington was ordained a high priest. I better back up a little bit and tell you because I'm not going to read you the whole paragraph. He's talking about when the founders of this nation appeared to Wilford Woodruff in the St. George Temple. Okay, now you probably all are aware that they appeared to Wilford Woodruff and waited on him day and night and saying, we established this nation under the principles of freedom so that you could be free and the gospel could be restored. And there's so much evidence that that occurred as a prelude. In fact, I've got statements that we could read later on if I get around to them, where, first of all, there's one little book called The Great Prologue up here by Mark E. Peterson that talks about the fact that this nation, with its constitution, had to be put in place before the gospel could be restored. J. Reuben Clark said, in no other place on earth could the gospel be restored, except it was restored in America under the Constitution. I mean, J. Reuben Clark was pretty adamant in those kinds of things. So anyway, here's what Ezra Taft Benson said, talking about that what happened in the St. George Temple. President George Washington was ordained a high priest at that time. You will also be interested to know that, according to Wilford Woodruff's journal, John Wesley, who was John Wesley? He was the founder of the Methodist religion. He's one of us. Okay, so George Washington was ordained a high priest. John Wesley was ordained a high priest. Benjamin Franklin and Christopher Columbus were also ordained high priests at that time. When one casts doubt about the character of these noble sons of God, I believe that he or she will have to answer to the God of heaven for it.
Whoa.
Pretty heavy indictment. And that goes right along with this statement in the 101st section of Doctrine and Covenants. God raised those men up for this very purpose. And they were the ones that redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. It was a great challenge. I truly believe that we need to go back to the original intent of the Founding Fathers. And any of you guys that have ever heard me on the radio, which I don't know if anybody's ever listening when I'm on, but the fact of the matter is that I get out there and I jabber away and it just seems, it goes on and the time's used up and then we're done. Yes, ma'am. Where or when? Well, when I'm invited, and most generally in recent time, it's been on Barbara Jean's show on K-Talk. Usually it's on Fridays. And I've made a point of my life, and it's one of my credos again. I have a lot of credos, I guess, to never pass up an open microphone when you can speak out in the cause of liberty. So that's why I'm here tonight, too. So anyway, when they call and they say, do you want to be on the radio? Sure. When? So anyway, noon to two is when Barbara Jean's on. Sometimes I'm on noon to two. Sometimes I'm on noon to one. Sometimes I'm on noon one to two. This Friday, which is tomorrow, I'll be on from 1 to 2, and I don't know what's going to happen because we have this perennial problem. It's called a hate crimes bill, and I'm far afield now from where I was going to go with this thing, but the hate crimes bill is continually brought up every year, and fortunately for Utahns, it has not made much inroad, but every year they modify it a little bit, and this year it's almost more insidious than it has been in previous years. So I thought I'd just talk about that for about an hour. Maybe we'll take calls, maybe we'll give that up after a few minutes, maybe, I don't know, but we'll see what happens.
What time is the hate crimes?
1 to 2 on Friday on K-Talk, which is 6:30 a.m. in Salt Lake. We can't get the place in, we can't get it in Cache Valley where I live, but when Tammy can get on, my wife can get, by the way, that's my wife over there, wave Tammy.
This Friday,
tomorrow. Yes, 1 to 2 in the afternoon. Yes? That's exactly right, but she has sometimes trouble getting on the computer, and I don't know if it's because of congestion on the network or what, but she has had problems like that, and they tell me that they get calls from people in Europe that are listening and everything else, so it's really kind of a strange thing for a little tiny station in Utah to be getting that where. Now, what you're getting back to your question back here about this perverse stuff that's going on, and I wished I had a whiteboard or blackboard or whatever they're using nowadays here to kind of draw how we got into this bucket of trouble. And again, it's kind of a little far afield from what we're trying to do here with the gospel orientation on the Constitution. But it's such that case law has got us in this bucket of problems. And if you can envision for a second a straight line from the beginning to the end, and this is a straight line of proper government, well, back in the 1870s, they started relying on something called case law. And case law said, we're going to look back to this previous court case and how it was determined to see how we're going to rule on this court case. See, before they were going clear back to the beginning and saying, this is what we were interested in. I'm going to talk about this in Ezra Taft Benson's words in just a second. They went back to the beginning, but now they started going back to the last case that applied in a similar situation, and if that one was just a few degrees off, you can see what it did to the trajectory of the case. Well, what if the next case went back to here, and they were a few degrees off again, and they went back to this case, and it was a few degrees off, and you can see how pretty soon we're completely off track from where we were. Yes, sir. His point is well taken, and I hope you all heard it. See, England really doesn't have a constitution as we have. I mean, they have a whole bunch of things that have happened all down through history. You know, the Magna Carta and the rights that came out of William and the Orange and all that kind of stuff and the Acts of Parliament. And they just keep kind of building this process. But what we did is we started out with an organic document that has written words, and those words can be known. And I've spent a lifetime of studying the words of those that wrote it. And they collate together, they're woven together in great beauty, They said what they meant. They meant what they said. If you want to know what they said, you can go read it. You can go back and look up the definitions of the words. And in fact, I've got in one of these little books up here that we put together when we teach young people. When I teach young people the farewell address, George Washington's farewell address, it usually takes 6 hours. They have to write 6 papers. But they also have to do, they have to go through, we've taken 500 words out of the farewell address that young people today, and probably most of us, aren't that familiar with. And I defined those words out of the Webster's 1828 dictionary, which was the first comprehensive American dictionary. And the kids have to be able to define those words and use them in context in a sentence. And that way, when they read the farewell address, they can say, oh, I understand what it means. Now, it was mentioned that my master's degree was in public administration, and I had my undergraduate focus in political science. You would have thought that Federalist Papers would have been part of the curriculum somewhere along the line, but they were not until I was well into my master's degree. And we had some readings in the master's program in regards to the Federalist Papers. You probably, most people know that those papers were written by Hamilton, Jay, and Madison. And by the way, the sparkling brilliance of Madison overwhelms them all. I wished he had written all of the Federalist Papers, but he didn't. But the Federalist Papers are written in a much more powerful language than we use today. And when I was in my master's program, we had people that were in the class, and we had these few scatterings of Federalist Papers to read. And some of the people were saying, nobody can understand this. What are they saying? I mean, they were just beside themselves in what was being said there, and they could not read them. In 1789 and 1788, when they were published in America, they were published in the newspapers. Now, today's newspapers are written ostensibly for the seventh grade level. In those days, if they were written for the seventh grade level, they were pretty bright seventh graders. And they really did understand. So anyway, our idea is if we can get the young people to understand the words that were used in George Washington's farewell address, then they can read the Federalist Papers, and they can read some of these other things, like St. George Tucker's writings, for example. They can go back and read, commentaries on the laws of England by Blackstone. They can go back and read Montesquieu. Of course, it was translated in 1750 in English, and it was French to begin with. But the point of the matter is, you can go back and actually delve into these things and understand what was said. You read John Locke and some of his treatise on government. Anyway, I'm getting far afield. Now, and I've told this story, I think I've even told it on the radio, so maybe some of you have heard it before, but when I was a kid, I used to haul hay. It was one of the best jobs I ever had. Now, I know some of you that hauled hay think I'm insane for sure now, but I loved that job because at the end of the day, you could say, there's a stack of hay, I put it up, and it was there. And it was, it was kind of a man's work for a kid. And, when I was 14, 15 years old, and we could outwork the 18, 19-year-olds that sometimes come on the farm, it was like, yes. Those boys would get broken down after about half a day, and it was something of pride to us, and that shows how prideful I am, perhaps. But nonetheless, when we were hauling hay, it was hot, dirty, dry work. And we had springs on the grounds where we worked, and when, we were done for a break or whatever, which didn't come often enough. You go over and lay on the belly, on your belly, and drink the water right out of the ground. And it was so sweet and fresh and just refreshing. It was life-giving, actually, it felt. And it was such a wonderful place to do that. But if the water went through the pastures and it went out through the corrals and the cows had walked in it and done all the other things that they do in it, it was not good and sweet anymore. It was a mess. And that's exactly the condition we're in right now with the court system based upon case law. And so it is abominable. And what needs to happen is they need to go back to the original intent of the founders. And I'm just going to quote out of, and by the way, if any of you have this enzyme at home, it's the November 1987, and it's got our Divine Constitution, is Ezra Taft Benson's talk. Marvelous, monumental talk on this subject. And he outlines how we can save the Constitution. And he goes through, and I probably ought to read you all of them, but I'll just hit the high points and then come to the second one that your comment brought up. First and foremost, we must be righteous. Okay, so we've got to get our act together and become a moral and religious people. We've got to recognize the God of the land. We've got to continue to serve him. Okay, and by the way, He says here, two great American Christian civilizations, the Jaredites and the Nephites, were swept off this land because they did not serve the God of the land, who is Jesus Christ. Then he says, what will become of our civilization? I think that question is yet to be answered. Second, and this was the point about the original intent, we must learn the principles of the Constitution in the tradition of the founding fathers. Okay? It can't be this wellspring that flowed through the pastures and the corrals that we learn it from. He says we need to learn it in the tradition of the founding fathers. Have we read the Federalist Papers? Are we reading the Constitution and pondering it? Are we aware of its principles? Are we abiding by these principles and teaching them to others? Could we defend the Constitution? Can we recognize when a law is constitutionally unsound? Do we know what the prophets have said about the Constitution and the threats to it? Then he quotes Jefferson. If a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects to be what never was and never will be. Okay, that's the second point. The third one is we must become involved in civic affairs to see that we're properly represented, and then he tells some about that. And then fourth, we must make our influence felt by our vote, our letters, our teaching, and our advice. And then he makes a very marvelous promise. I probably ought to just sit down after I say this because it's like, we've got our charge. Let's go do it. But I won't. I'll stay up here for a while longer. We'll read a few more things, then we'll get done when you guys want me to be. Okay, here's what he says, though. I have faith that the Constitution will be saved as prophesied by Joseph Smith. It will be saved by the righteous citizens of this nation who love and cherish freedom. It will be saved by enlightened members of this church, among others, men and women who understand and abide the principles of the Constitution. I reverence, and this is a quote I've got in this paper that I just handed out to you, so you'll see this again. I reverence the Constitution of the United States as a sacred document. To me, its words are akin to the revelations of God, for God has placed his stamp of approval upon it. Again, incorporating the Constitution by reference to the Scriptures. Okay, then we go on. I don't go on. Ezra Taft Benson does. I testify that the God of heaven sent some of his choicest spirits to lay the foundation of this government, and he has now sent other choice spirits to help preserve it. We, the blessed beneficiaries of the Constitution, face difficult days in America, a land which is choice above all other lands. May God give us the faith and courage exhibited by those patriots who pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. May we be equally as valiant and free, I pray. So said Ezra Taft Benson back on the bicentennial of the United States Constitution. And I think that we do have a great charge there, that we have a responsibility to uphold. Okay, well, so much for case law. The tradition of the founding fathers is what we've got to be founded on. That was a long answer to that question. Okay, 109th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 54. What is the 109th section of the Doctrine and Covenants? It is the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple. Now, Joseph Smith had never dedicated a temple before. He didn't know how to do it. And he says that he went before the Lord and said, how do I do this? And the Lord said, I'll dictate it to you. Of course, he didn't use those exact words, but those are the words that we understand today. So Joseph Smith sat down and wrote the dedicatory prayer to the Kirtland Temple. These are the Lord's words that he wanted Joseph to say when the Kirtland Temple was being dedicated. And in verse 54, it says, have mercy, O Lord, upon all the nations of the earth. Have mercy upon the rulers of our land. May those principles which were so honorably and nobly defended, namely the Constitution of our land, by our fathers, be established forever. That was the Lord saying that. I mean, you can quibble about what did he really mean, but he said it and asked Joseph Smith to say it at the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple. Now, I have here also, and I wished I had time to go through the whole thing since we're on a dedicatory prayer, but let me just see if I can find here quickly an abbreviation of another dedicatory prayer. It was the dedicatory prayer of the Idaho Falls Temple. Now, there were some here probably that were there when the Idaho Falls Temple was dedicated. And I just want to take just a minute to read about 15 to 20%. I haven't actually done the word count, but about in that range, almost one-fifth of the dedicatory prayer of the Idaho Falls Temple was dedicated to preserving the Constitution of the United States. And if you read this, you'll say, my gracious, it talks about this premortal thing and how it came to earth and how the war that started in heaven is still going on now, and governments are trying to destroy that, and Satan's trying to destroy the government of the United States. And I mean, well, I'll just read it to you. You don't need my interpretation of it. Here's the Idaho Falls Temple President George Albert Smith. He petitioned God with these words. And I don't know, I have not been able to discover that the Lord revealed this to him, but he was the prophet, and he was the one that said it. So he says, "We thank thee, O God, for the choice land upon which we reside, and for the marvelous promises thou hast made concerning America, that it should be free from bondage and from captivity and from all other nations under heaven, so long as the inhabitants of the land should worship the God of the land, who is Jesus Christ. Thou hast revealed unto us that in the great controversy which took place in heaven, that the cornerstone of thy plan of salvation was the free agency of man, and that Lucifer, who was an angel in authority in thy holy presence, proposed a different way, that Lucifer's plan was rejected because the effect of its application would be to deprive the children, thy children, of their free agency. When Lucifer's plan was rejected by thee, he rebelled against thee. There was war in heaven, and he and his followers were cast out. We thank thee that thou hast warned us by revelation that Satan would deceive the nations in our time. As we look about the world among the various countries, we find philosophies and forms of government, the effect of which is to deprive men of their free agency. But by reason of thy timely warning to us, we know that they are not approved of thee. Since the God of this choice land is Jesus Christ, we know that his philosophy of free agency should prevail here. There are those, our Heavenly Father, both within and without our borders, who would destroy the constitutional form of government which thou hast so magnanimously given us, and would replace it with a form that would curtail, if not altogether deprive, man of his free agency. We thank thee that thou hast revealed to us that those men who gave us our constitutional form of government were men wise in thy sight, and that thou didst raise them up for the very purpose of putting forth that sacred document." I mean, that clearly outlines in a very succinct manner what this whole program's about. The prophets have prayed so fervently before God that somehow we might preserve those things so we could retain our agency. It started in the premortal existence. And so the little tiny people that come in here today, we need to preserve it so that they'll be able to have it for their children too. Well, I'm probably ought to move on. We're pretty heavily into this, but let's go on to what Joseph Smith said. "Hence, we say that the Constitution of the United States is a glorious standard. It is founded in wisdom. It is a heavenly banner, and is to all those that are who are privileged with the sweets of its liberty, like the cooling shade and refreshing water," there's that water again that just came out of the spring, "of a great rock in a thirsty and weary land. It is like a great tree under whose branches men of every clime can be shielded from the burning rays of an inclement sun. We say that God is true." Now listen to this. He groups some things together here that you say, wow, where's this placed in the whole sequence of things? "We say that God is true, that the Constitution of the United States is true, that the Bible is true, the Book of Mormon is true, that Christ is true, that the ministering of angels is true." He put the Constitution with some pretty heavy, important doctrine in our religion. Yes, ma'am? Well, it's on the sheet we passed out, but okay, I'll give you, let's see if I can find here quickly. There's Times and Seasons, Volume 1, page 134, and the Teachings of Prophet Joseph Smith, page 148. That's where one of those things came from. There's multiple places where Joseph Smith endorsed the Constitution, and that's just one of the endorsements. Okay, well, Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith is the one you probably have. Read page 148. But do a search in the index about Constitution of the United States. And by the way, I've got it here, but I'm not going to read the whole thing. Joseph Smith made a statement that seems rather radical to many of us today. Maybe not to this group, but to some people. He said that capital punishment should be inflicted upon those that hold office in the United States and refuse to uphold their oath of office of the Constitution. Yes, ma'am. And he suggested that that should have applied in his day, by the way. And I've got some other things here. I mean, we could really go far afield on this, to tell you the truth. But I'll tell you what, Joseph Smith had some very strong opinions about some of those that led this nation at that time, and he didn't have a very high opinion of many of them. And in fact, he went so far as to call the President of the United States at the time a fool and a fop, which sometimes applies in more modern terms, too. Many of you know that Joseph Smith ran for President of the United States in 1844. And there were no Gallup polls in those days. But there's a very high probability that he would have been elected President of the United States had he not been assassinated on June 27th. He put together this little document here, and you can read it in the church, the history of the church. But he published a little document about his views on government. Marvelous read. I mean, insights into what he really understood about proper government. He had solutions in here, for example, to the slavery problem. If his solution had been administered in the United States, it would have solved a couple of big issues. One is slavery, and the other one is the Civil War, and the other one is the federal lands issue. Basically, Joseph Smith said, we've got to get rid of slavery, but we've got these contending viewpoints. And how do we do it? Because the guys that own the slaves think they're private property. And everybody else says, it's an abominable thing. And it is abominable, by the way. And how do we get out of this thing? Extricate ourselves from this horrible situation. He says, what we do is we sell the federal lands. We take the proceeds from those sales. We buy the slaves from those slaveholders, emancipate them, and give them a set of land as a kind of a reparation, if you will, for the slavery they'd been held in, so that they would become productive members of society, so that the land would go into the hands of the Americans that had bought the land. There would be land placed in the hands of those that were set free from slavery, and they would be able to support themselves. And those that had held the slaves would receive remuneration for what they would have thought of as a financial loss, and everybody all around could have won. Everybody would have won. Exactly. And, of course, that idea was later on proposed in the late 1850s, but by then, the lines were drawn and we were going to kill each other no matter what happened, and so they ended up not being able to do that. But Joseph Smith proposed that in 1844. He also proposed about, yes, ma'am? The land was redeemed by shedding of blood. Read that. He raised up these men for the purpose of redeeming the land by the shedding of blood. And that had, the price had been paid if we would have been willing to, but we had to pay it again because we killed the prophet. We didn't, you and I, and probably, hopefully not any of our ancestors, but the prophets were killed. Now, another two or three things. He had a banking system for the Americas. Now, some of you know that Hamilton, and I've mentioned his name in derogatory ways now twice, Hamilton created the federal bank, if you will. It was not as bad as the Federal Reserve is today. And I'm getting far afield again, and I'm sorry. But Hamilton had been instrumental in chartering this bank. And it had been a scourge on the nation. And guys like Jefferson and Madison and those guys were really, they had heartburn over it. It really polluted the original Congresses almost immediately. They became more interested in their own personal gain in the office than they were in administering the affairs of the nation. There were some that kept their virtue, of course, but there were many that were polluted by this. And the nation was suffered greatly because of it. And there was big problems. Well, Andrew Jackson, who was the seventh president of the United States and the last president that had any skin in the game from the Revolutionary War, if you will, he had been a little boy. He was 13 years old, as I recall, had run away and joined the army. Well, he didn't really run away. His mom knew he went. But at any rate, he joined the army. He was captured by the British. He wasn't going to polish the boots of one of the British officers, and so the British officer took a whack at him with his saber, and he protected himself with his hand, and he blocked the blow somewhat, but it cut his hand and his head, but he didn't end up getting killed. So anyway, he had shed his blood in the Revolutionary War too. And he was a rough-and-tumble kind of guy. Andrew Jackson was. He was much more brilliant than most people and historians ever give him credit for being. And when it came time to renew the charter for the federal bank, he said, no, we're not going to do this. And Biddle, who was the head guy of the Federal Bank at the time, says, oh, you're going to regret this, and we did. And in fact, Joseph Smith was caught in that mess, and he nearly got killed in Kirtland because of all of the financial problems that happened at that time. But Jackson held the line. He didn't renew the charter. The Senate said they were going to censure him. And if you haven't read his response to their censure, that's a brilliant constitutional defense. He says, and I'm going to synopsize about 15 pages, to get out of here. The Constitution says you can impeach me and throw me out of office. It doesn't say you can censure me, so either impeach me and throw me out of office or shut up. I mean, that's in a few words what he said in 15 pages, but it was a brilliant synopsis of the limitations of Congress in the Constitution. And he was a lot brighter guy than most of the people that are in office nowadays. But at any rate, so Joseph Smith had a federal bank in here that was not going to be a private bank, that someone could control and manipulate and make money off of. It was going to be one that was owned by the United States and run by the United States. It was going to be money that we didn't have to create debt for in order to get money, which we do with the Federal Reserve now, and we've got $8 trillion. And if you do the math on that, it's probably $26,000 or $27,000 per person in your family that we owe on that federal debt. But Joseph Smith, it was a brilliant plan. This document was being carried by the apostles as they went across the United States and proselyted to the gospel. They were proselyting the election of Joseph Smith. And I have letters in my files. I didn't bring them tonight. But I have letters in my files from the apostles as they wrote back to the prophet as late as the middle of June 1844. And they were talking about how excited the nation was at receiving this information. They went to the prominent people of the nation at the time, the newspaper publishers and stuff, and they said, you know what? It's not since Washington and Jefferson has there been a man that has been so cogent in his views about proper government. We'll support this man. I mean, it was like fire starting across the prairie. Anyway, he was killed a few days later. But you ought to get a hold of that if you haven't got the church. Well, this one's called The Prophet Joseph Smith's Views on the Powers and Policy of the Government of the United States. Okay. it'll be on the table. You can come up. But I'll just quickly say it again. The Prophet Joseph Smith's Views on the Powers and Policy of the Government of the United States. Yes, sir. It's also in the church, in the history of the church, too. So there's a number of places you can find it. But you ought to read it. I mean, and when he talks about a national bank, it is not a bank in the same form or mold as the Federal Reserve. So don't get confused. Yes, ma'am. Maybe most of you heard that already, but she's commenting on the fact that the Federal Reserve today is nothing like what Joseph Smith had proposed. It is a privately held consortium of banks, and I wish we had time tonight to go into this too, but you know, there's so many side trips I could take. You guys haven't even asked me about war yet, and maybe we won't have time, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is, Federal Reserve, when Congress says that we're gonna spend this amount of money, it's like, where do we get it? Has anybody thought about that for a second? They go walking across the street with their hand out to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve goes, and how much did you want? Well, only $2.5 trillion this time, I'm sorry. And they might write it into their journal as a loan to the United States. Where did that money come from? They didn't even print it yet. They created it out of... It didn't exist anywhere. It didn't exist anywhere. And the interesting thing, Greenspan and his tenure here created approximately, it's between $6 and $7 trillion. Now, what happens when you create dollars? The buying power of each of those dollars is diminished. And here's another side trip I got to take. I apologize to you all. Maybe you want to leave. If you start leaving, I'll end. But here's how when I teach young people, and there's a lot more to this story because I teach them about the kulaks in Russia during Stalin and farming and everything else when I do this. Okay, but the what? Well, the kulaks were a landed peasantry in Russia in the 1920s and 30s. And when Stalin collectivized the farms, he basically said, you guys got to give me your land. And what do we say about the necessity of property to be have a people as agency and be free and everything like that? And these people, there was over 10 million of them, said, no way, we're not giving you the land. And Stalin came in and annihilated them. He did it by starvation and a quicker method called artillery. But he literally laid waste to entire cities. He surrounded them with artillery and just turned it to rubble. And he bragged to Churchill and Roosevelt later that he killed 10 million of those people. Now, there was, on a lesser degree, by the way, that was being done in the United States in the 1930s, too, by Roosevelt's administration to some of the farmers. They didn't use artillery, but they used other methods to destroy their livelihood. But we won't go there right now. But the fact that here's how I teach young people about this thing about money being injected into society. Yes, ma'am. For a lot of years, we homeschooled our children until they got beyond that age. And we had a homeschool study group in our home. We had, for quite a number of years, 25 people. That's all we could fit in our basement. We converted a room in the basement to a classroom, and it had desks and chairs and all that kind of stuff and blackboards and, you know, all that kind of stuff you'd expect in a classroom. And we had 25 or 26 kids come to our home three times a week for, what was it, 4 or 5 hours a day? Something like that. And we taught all sorts of subjects. I taught history and government. And Tammy is an artist and a multi-talented person, and she did a lot of other things, creative writing and things with the kids. But some of the other parents, we had physicians and doctors. Physicians and doctors are usually the same. Physicians and dentists that had their children in the classroom too, and they taught biology and physics and things like that. And it was really kind of a challenging experience. But there were a lot of kids that came out of that I think wouldn't have had a chance in life if we hadn't have done that. I mean, some of the kids are walking wounded when they come in, it seems like, nowadays. But at any rate, they have to detoxify from the other way that they're being taught. But at any rate, okay, let's get back to the money thing. So in this story, and I won't go through the whole story because we won't have time tonight, I'm always the good guy in my stories, okay? I create a tractor. And these are an agrarian people, and they have to work very hard to be able to you know, support their families. They plow with horses and everything, and, you know, it's a whole scenario we create. And I create a tractor. And with that tractor, I tell them how many acres they could plow a day. And I build this scenario about how cool this tractor is, but there's only one of them, okay? And before I do this, I've handed to every child in the room a $100 bill, not a real one, okay, a fake one. Okay, so they each have a Monopoly money thing, only we made the money up, and which is about what the Federal Reserve does anyway. But at any rate, and by the way, and I won't go into it now either because we're getting so far afield from what I hoped thought we were going to talk about tonight. But I get into fractional banking too, and intrinsic value of money, and all those kinds of things, and how, of course, I'm the good guy always. I'm the one that holds the gold that they don't have to carry around in their pockets because it wears a hole in their pockets, and I issued money to them, you know, that says, anytime you present this to me, I'll give you gold. I'll give you your gold back if you give me your little receipt that says you gave me 3 ounces of gold, you know. And it takes quite a while to tell this whole story, by the way. So anyway, but you're getting the idea that I'm holding their gold, and I've discovered a couple of things. They never all ask for the gold at the same time. And so I start putting a little more money out, you know, so I can loan people things, too, on an interest level, too. So anyway, you're getting the idea how fractional banking is something the bankers have connived in order to make more money off of all of us. But, so everybody has a $100 bill in their hand. And so I'm holding this little tractor that I've, you know, is a model of what I've created for them. And they're all farmers, and they want to be able to plow their land better and be able to take more time fishing and playing with their kids and all this kind of stuff. So I said, so how much will you buy this tractor from me for? And, of course, the bidding starts at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. It gets up to 100, and it stops. And I said, well, why'd you stop? Well, that's all the money we have. Well, what's wrong with you guys doing a co-op? Why don't you three, you know, you're not going to use the tractor all the time, and you could share it. And so suddenly the bidding goes to 300, and then they build bigger consortiums. But it never goes up more than about $900 for this tractor. And then I hand each of them a $10,000 bill, again, fake. And I said, how much am I bid for the tractor now? Immediately, the bidding starts in the thousands, and it goes up to hundreds of thousands ultimately. See, what happened? You can't do any more work with this tractor How come it's worth so much more money? We had more. And all it was printed because this guy back here made more money. I mean, I was in back there printing the more money up, you know, so I could, you know. So anyway, and the kids go, oh yeah, that's how inflation works. Well, that's what's happening in America, and that's how we got this multi-trillion-dollar debt that we're stuck with. That all it happened, there's no more value in the nation, really. In fact, I'm spending way too much time on this. There's an interesting story you can tell, too. In 1920, 1 ounce of gold would buy one men's suit, and so would a $20 bill. Okay? That's right. An ounce of gold was $20 in those days. Okay? Now, it takes about $400 to buy a good man's suit or an ounce of gold. What changed? We printed more money. But the suit and the gold still have a similar value of exchange. See? So what we've done is we've taken our nation off of constitutional money, and we've gone to this false philosophy of men about how men can make money off of the challenges of their fellow man, and now we have the Federal Reserve and all those attendant evils. Anyway, how did I get off on that? I don't know. Easy, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's so many other tracks we could take, but let's go back to this for a second. Let's go back to Brigham Young. I want to say to every man, the Constitution of the United States, as formed by our fathers, was dictated, was revealed, was put into their hearts by the Almighty, who sits enthroned in the midst of the heavens. Although unknown to them, it was dictated by the revelations of Jesus Christ, and I tell you in the name of Jesus Christ, it is as good as I could ask for. Whoa. What an endorsement. Brigham Young. Well, we won't go there. Joseph Smith, he said a lot more things. When they created the charter for Nauvoo, the Constitution of the United States is mentioned 7 times in that charter. They had a great love of the Constitution. Okay, well, let's go on here. We have to skip forward. Ezra Taft Benson, I already told you, he reverenced the Constitution as a sacred document, and his words were akin to Scripture, for God had placed a stamp of approval on it. And then Gordon B. Hinckley. Oh, wait a minute. We skipped to David O. McKay, didn't we? There's a lot of things David O. McKay said. And by the way, a lot of people said, oh, Ezra Taft Benson is so radical about this constitutional stuff. I mean, my gracious. He's the only guy that cares about this. Well, he was following his leader. David O. McKay and the First Presidency were extremely vocal about it in their day. And J. Reuben Clark was an incredible, he was probably one of the premier constitutionalists in the 20th century. And he was a member of the First Presidency from the 1930s forward. A brilliant man and great constitutionalist. But anyway, David O. McKay said, no greater immediate responsibility rests upon the members of the church, upon all citizens of this republic and of neighboring republics, than to protect the freedom vouchsafed by the Constitution of the United States. Pretty important. Then let's go to Gordon B. Hinckley, and maybe we ought to not talk too much. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Gordon B. Hinckley. And by the way, he said this in a June fireside in 1997, and he also said it in this little book, Standing for Something. He said it in the introduction. And it's interesting, by the way, this is another little side story that I shouldn't probably even tell, but some years ago when this first came out, I was on a high council, and I attended in the bishopric meetings of the ward I was assigned to every Sunday. And one of the bishopric members, when we had started the meeting, we were well into it, and one of the bishopric members came walking in late, and he had this under his arm with the scriptures and stuff, and as he went past me, I said, good book. He said, yeah. He says, let me ask you something. He says, did you write the introduction? And I said, yeah. He says, I'm really flattered that you'd think that, but Gordon B. Hinckley wrote that book, not me. But it's really got some great stuff in it, and maybe we'll quote from it even beyond this one here. But on that sheet I handed out to you, A news magazine writer asked me the other day during an interview concerning my belief in the Constitution of our country. I replied that I felt it was inspired, that both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States were brought forth under the inspiration of God to establish and sustain the freedom of the people of this nation. I told him that I looked upon the Founding Fathers as men who believed in God, as men who prayed to God, as men who recognized God and wished to do His will. What a singular and remarkable group they were. As I look across the world today, I search in vain for such a group as walked together across the stage of history when this nation was born. Just think for a moment of George Washington, of Franklin, of Madison, of the Adams, of Thomas Jefferson and their associates who signed the Declaration of Independence or participated in the Constitutional Convention. Where in all the world today can even one or two such men be found, let alone the great aggregation who participated in the birth of America? Can anyone deny that they were raised up unto this very purpose, that working together they brought forth on this continent an independent nation at the risk of their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor? It is my conviction that while we've had a few great leaders since then, there has not been before or since so large a group of talented, able, and dedicated men as those we call the founding fathers of this nation. For as long as they lived, they acknowledged the hand of the Almighty in the affairs of this republic. It's interesting to use that term, republic. Do we often hear it called something else? We do. And, of course, the Founding Fathers were very adamant about being a republic. Do you have? It was not just shot down or shouted down. I was there. I was appalled. I was prepared to speak on that. I've talked on the radio about this, the fact that I've read the Patriot Act. I testified in front of the United States Senate Judiciary Committee in regards to the Patriot Act and the concerns of the issues that are associated with the Patriot Act. It's a grave encroachment on our liberties. Your points are well taken. Ezra Taft Benson's talk, by the way, is found in this little book, if you can't get it online or something. The God, Family, Country, Our Three Great Loyalties. I always say people steal this book if you can find it, but don't, because mine's the only one up here. But it's out of print now, and you're going to have to go to some place. There's Deseret Book sometime, not Deseret Book, Deseret Industries. God, Family, Country, Our Three Great Loyalties. And it was written by Ezra Taft Benson. It reads like Today's News Today. Yes, ma'am. You can find them. We used to, when we were going out of print, we would go into places and buy them up by stacks. And we give them as gifts and everything else like that, but we're out of them. This is our last one, I think, Tammy. Yes.
Let me ask you, how come
it is out of print, and I can't answer that question. And let me show you another book you ought to have, by the way, which is there's only about two cases left. There's about three cases left in the whole world that are out there. I own one of the cases of these. And this is called Prophets, Principles, National Survival. It was compiled by Gerald Newquist, and it was recommended in General Conference a number of years ago, of course. But An Enemy Hath Done This is a big issue, too. There's no question about that. An Enemy Hath Done This reads like Today's News Today. And An Enemy Hath Done This literally is like, hey, there it is right there, hold it up so that people can see it. Did you steal that up here?
No.
I can't find mine right now. I thought I brought mine today, but I don't have it here. Yeah, let's see. Couple, two, three. Let's go back here, and then here. Let me tell you what happened when this book was going out of print the first time. Ezra Taft Benson called Joe Ferguson, a good friend of some of us in here. I know some of you know Joe. And said, Joe, this book's going out of print. You can't let that happen. And Joe got a whole bunch of them printed up, cases and cases and cases of them. And I've been one of his primary purchasers over the years because we've given this book for gifts and stuff for many years. But Joe is almost out. I think he's got two cases left. And I don't know if it's possible to print them again because the original plates that they were printed off, for some reason, are not, they're missing or something. They're going to have to be recreated. So anyway, that's one of the problems. But you're right. An Enemy Hath Done This, God, Family, Country, Our Three Great Loyalties. I mean, these books are really good, and it's like Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. I told you that earlier. And quite frankly, these books tell it like it is. Now, An Enemy Hath Done This takes its title from Matthew chapter 13, as I recall, where, you know, the good man sowed his field with grain, And when everybody slept at night, they came in and sowed tares. And remember the story about how the servants, when the thing sprung up, they're going, how'd that get there? Didn't we sow good grain? What's the deal? Let's go pluck it up. And the good master said, no, we're going to leave the wheat and the tares to grow together. Because, you know, by tearing up the tares, we'll probably destroy the good crop too. We're going to let them mature together, but before we harvest, we'll gather the tares out and burn them, and then we'll harvest the good grain. Now, that might be part of the reason why things are so silent today. The tares are growing among the wheat. And I get frustrated that we don't have a chance to have a little more voice in this thing, but we've never been told, really, that the words of the prophets are null and void. Back here in the back, you had a comment, and I'm sorry for taking so much time when you could have been talking. I presume that it would be possible if somebody had more time, money, and talent than I've got, but I'll bet you it could be done. Take them with you and use them as references, and if it will be even better if you could do a database search on them and be able to look up something that J. Reuben Clark said about not standing by the president when he's taking the nation astray. I'll read you that in just a second out of here. It's really cool. Go ahead, sir, again to the very back still. I wish somebody would look into that, because honestly, these are gems that when they're lost, there'll be so few out there for people to get them in their hands. Get in the back, sir. Well, you know, I've never heard that story before, but let me just give you a couple little thoughts. Just out of the scriptures. One of them's in 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's when the people came before Samuel and said, we want a king. And this is, I'm talking about going against the words of the prophet, you know, the advice and counsel of the prophet. The people came in and said, we want a king. We want to be like everybody else. And the prophet said, you don't want a king? I mean, read 1 Samuel chapter 8. And it's very explicit. It gives in much more detail than I will. But he said, he'll do all these bad things to you. And they said, yeah, but we still want a king. We want to be like everybody else. Samuel, very discouraged and disheartened, went before the Lord and said, they've rejected me. And the Lord said, no, they haven't rejected you, Samuel. They've rejected me. Give them a king. And he never spoke against the king again. Samuel went out and chose the first king based upon the wishes of the people. The Lord gives us what we want sometimes. So that's in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And then there's another little interesting tidbit in Mormon chapter 1. Remember when Mormon was chosen to be a, you know, at age 10, the prophet noticed he was a, you know, sober-minded young man and quick to observe. So anyway, when he was 15, he says, I being 15 years of age and being somewhat of a sober mind, therefore I was visited of the Lord and tasted anew of the goodness of Jesus. And I did endeavor to preach unto this people, but my mouth was shut, and I was forbidden that I should preach unto them. For behold, they had willfully rebelled against their God, and the beloved disciples were taken away out of the land because of their iniquity. But I did remain among them, but I was forbidden to preach unto them because of the hardness of their hearts, and because of the hardness of their hearts, the land was cursed for their sake. Well, that's Mormon chapter 1. You want to read probably 15, 16, and 17. But then there's another little interesting tidbit of a scripture. It's in the 82nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. And again, we're far afield maybe, but we're still talking about this. Verse 22, 82nd section, verse 22. And now verily I say unto you, and this is wisdom, make unto yourselves friends with the mammon of unrighteousness, and they will not destroy you. The brethren that are leading the church have an awful lot on their plate. They have a huge task. They've got to try and take the message of salvation and the saving ordinances to all the peoples of the world before 1 Nephi chapter 14 happens. Okay? And if you want to go back and read about in 1 Nephi chapter 4, I'm not going to go through it. But in 1 Nephi chapter 14, basically it talks about this abominable church that's all over the world and how the members of the church are all over the world too, but the bad guys start fighting against the membership in the church. And the big hammer comes down on their head. Doesn't quite use those terms. But 1 Nephi chapter 14 is going to be a challenging time for the church. And maybe, just maybe, I don't know. I mean, I'm not in those circles, and I wouldn't presuppose to speak for them. But what if we have chosen to follow the way of the world? What if we have said we want to be like the rest of the world so much? As was said earlier, 70% of the people think that our administration is on the right track by declaring unconstitutional laws and by seeking to have the Patriot Act enacted, which destroys the Constitution and the 4th Amendment at least, What if we have we've just got to keep plowing ahead? And you know, I'll think about this scenario for just a second. And there's more to this story that I'm going to tell you tonight. But what if, think if you were in this condition, you're a farmer. You're absolutely required to, what you grow, you eat. Your family starves if you don't grow. You've got a tremendous responsibility to get the harvest in. The cry of war goes throughout the land. What do you do? Do you go off and fight the war? Or do you stay home and harvest the crops? I think, in a way, the brethren are harvesting as fast as they can. Somebody's got to fight the war. Somebody's got to be courageous enough to stand in the gap and say, no, you will not encroach. We will fight this. We will stop it. We will do a holding action, whatever it takes, so that you guys that are doing the harvest can go do that. Are those warriors you? I don't know. But when I first had that scenario presented to me, and they said, what would you do? Would you go fight or would you continue to harvest? I said, my family will figure something out. I'm going to fight. So let's go here and then a couple over here. And then go ahead, sir. But still, I think that there's warriors here. And I'll just tell you something that when I first introduced this whole concept of whatever we're talking about tonight, this was, by the way, a family that ended up homeschooling with us and they had their kids come to our little, what do we call it, a study group? Anyway. They had never even conceived of these notions before. And when they got them, it was like, whoa! And he was a physician. He was very good friends with Elder Neil Maxwell. And he wrote him and he says, why don't you guys say something about this? Why don't you do something? Elder Neil Maxwell wrote back and said, why don't you? And so that's the question. Why don't you? Oh, over here. Excellent point. Let me just ask you something. What if this next general conference, they didn't talk about adultery as being bad? Okay, I guess it's okay now. Oh, we're not going to say something like that. What if they didn't mention tithing? What if they didn't mention about husbands loving your wives and whatever? I mean, you take any topic you want. If it's not talked about in general conference for two or three times, does it suddenly fall off the edge of the earth? I think not. Yes, here and then. Well, I'm losing track of the hands here. To be fair, I ought to have you take a number. Let me tell you another quick story here. I got to keep moving on here. I am a very different kind of person. You've already understood that, I know, probably. But I've always wanted to know what was on the other side of the mountain. I always have. From my earliest memory as a little kid, I've wanted that. I ran away the first time when I was 4 years old. And here was why. I honestly thought, the mountains, I watched every night this big moon come over the mountains. And I watched it as it coursed across the sky. And I thought, if I can be on top of that mountain, when that moon just peeks over the top, I can leap over to it and I can ride across the sky and see the whole picture. And so I ran away to go get on the mountain. I was 4 years old. But I've always been that way. I still am that way. And from the time, one of my earliest memories, too, was at about that age, I heard that there was this sealed portion of the Book of Mormon. I mean, it was like, and I haven't even started talking about the Book of Mormon tonight for crying out loud and giving you my timeline or anything like that, but there was this sealed portion of the Book of Mormon, and it was like, oh, I got to see that. I want to read that. That would be so cool. I mean, you know, a little kid's mind. So from the time I've been a little tiny child, I've wanted that, and I've yearned for it. But just as was mentioned here, every time I get yearning again, it's, oh, my son, you don't understand everything I've given you already. How can I possibly open the rest to you? And so since I've been, in the last 25 or 30 years, some 25 years anyway, I've made it through the Book of Mormon at least six times a year. And I'm still discovering great and marvelous and wonderful truths that are just unfolding. It's like there's a wealth of knowledge. It's like, how did I overlook that last time? And that shows how stupid I am, I guess, because by now you'd think I'd have it memorized cover to cover. but it's one of those things that, have I done everything I can yet to understand that full document? Is the 84th section of the Doctrine and Covenants still apply to me, where the Lord says we're under indictment for not taking the Book of Mormon seriously? And so that's one of my things. I agree with you. Have we lived the things we've been told yet? And I think the answer is no, but we've got to try. Let's go here and then we'll go back there.
Remember
And it was placed in our hands. And quite frankly, there's some other talks in this God Family Country where it talks about the elders of Israel have been put to sleep. And Satan doesn't want to shake them. He doesn't want to get them aroused and get up and say, whoa, 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 what's happening? So we're basically, the laborers are few, but that's always the way it's been. Think of Gideon's example. You know, when he went into battle, he was going to go into battle with all these guys, and he says, the Lord says, no, you can't. You just can't. They'll say it was their victory. So you got to winnow this down. And they got it down to 300 guys, and then they finally went out and they won. Pretty cool. The Lord took the victory, not the people. Yes, sir, very back. And then we'll go over here. Well, the Book of Mormon, Ezra Taft Benson said, was one of the greatest handbooks for freedom ever written. And if you read the Book of Mormon, and if I ever hand you this little chart thing, you'll see a little bit of that in there. The fact of the matter is, the truth can be known if we'll seek it out. If we will seek it out. And we just can't, the brethren can't carry us all on everything. We've got to start moving forward. You're not done back there. I'm sorry to interrupt. That's right. He did. And I'll tell you another thing. When the Savior was on the earth, and the opposition grew, was mounting to his mission, and his mission wasn't done yet, what did he do? He started teaching in parables. And for those that were spiritually attuned, it was like, yeah, I get the message. For those that were not, it was like, huh, interesting story, good fable, whatever. Let's go here and then we'll go back to Frank. No, well, I'll tell you a couple of things first. I mean, one of the answers, H. Verlin Anderson told me one time when he and I were having this discussion. You guys know H. Verlin Anderson a little bit. Maybe he did, many are called, but few are chosen. He did the Great and Abominable Church of the Devil. He tried to get the Book of Mormon and the Constitution published before Ezra Taft Benson was put in as the prophet, didn't quite have it ready, and then it was blocked because it was so powerful that it just really kind of had to be held back. And it never was completely ready to be published. And Ezra Taft Benson desperately wanted it published before he was made the prophet, because he knew it would, if when he was the prophet, it would become it would become a lightning rod. But H. Verlin Anderson and I were talking one time about these very things, and I was so frustrated. You know, why can't these guys get up? Why can't we talk about this in, you know, big meetings and all that kind of stuff? And he says, Brother Bradley, he says, how does the Lord bring the truth to the world? Well, he sends out these two guys and they go in your living room and they sit down and talk with you. And once you understand that they care and they've got the Spirit and the Spirit testifies to you, and you get converted. And he says, exactly. He says, that's how we've got to take it to the world. We've got to be able to take the message to the world on a personal basis where you can help them understand. And you start with those you love. Isn't that what would happen if you knew the gospel was true? Wouldn't you go to your kids or your... Didn't Adam and Eve do that as soon as they found out about that? They said, wait a minute, we got to tell our kids this stuff. Or your parents, grandparents, whatever. Anyway, so that's what he said. And it was a much longer conversation than I just gave, because he was such a sweet person. He couldn't seem to grasp the frustration I had. Nobody could be that weak. One other quick thing about the media. Some of you that have heard me talk on the radio have heard me talk about a couple of books that were written in the days of the Founding Fathers, and it talks about Jacobism and the conspiracy. And in those books, if you get those books, they're very tedious to read. I got to tell you, they're written in a very old world style methodology, but they were published in 1798, as I recall. But it's you go through those books, and some of the books have in them documented some of the oaths that secret combinations take. And basically, they're very much like what Cain administered, about they swear upon their own heads and that their lives will be lost and everything else like that if they violate this. It's a very interesting read, although tedious because of the repetition and everything, which I do sometimes here too. But the point was that their interest was in controlling the printing organs. Okay? And that was so that they could control what was being given to the people that could read. Now, what do we have today? I mean, not only do we have the printing presses, that, you know, the large documents that are being sent out, but to the world by the magazines, you know, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, you know, whatever. You look at whatever magazine it is, and the people all gather together at the top. They're all Council on Foreign Relations members, and they're all in this whole problem together. But listen to this out of the 48th chapter of Alma, verse 1. Now it came to pass that as soon as Amalickiah had obtained the kingdom, he began to inspire the hearts of the Lamanites against the people of Nephi. Yea, he did appoint men to speak unto the Lamanites from their towers against the Nephites. What towers are we speaking from today? Radio towers, television towers, you know, the broadcast centers. I mean, man, this stuff, I mean, Satan found a formula, and we keep falling in the same traps. You know, if we aren't willing to learn from our past, we're doomed to repeat the same things. Where were we? Somebody was had a... Okay, we'll go here. I think that's very much of the answer. But have any of these things been countermanded? No. Are the truths of the Book of Mormon still there? Yes. Are we still in a war against Satan based upon agency? Yes, it hasn't changed. None of those things have changed. But the church itself has the saving ordinances. They have the saving doctrines. They have to get that message out. They have to get it out. Would the missionaries be precluded from going into a lot of countries? We already are, for crying out loud. And so consequently, there has to be another avenue. It has to be people that care enough to take this message forward. Do you have to be commanded in all things? Isn't, you know, the 58th section of the Doctrine and Covenants stick on our minds? You know, wicked and slothful servant that must be commanded in all things. You know, we need to go out and do some of these things on our own with freedom, like we got a mother. May I go do this? No. We've been given our charge. I think some of us made covenants in the premortal existence that said, we will stand with liberty. Let's go back here, Frank, and then we'll come to you. Well, and they're willing to recognize that some of those that are leading them are not good people because they're not of their faith, too. Let's go here, and then I'm going to take this segue to give you the Book of Mormon timeline. But go ahead there, and then we'll go there, and then we'll...
I think
well, and what you've just said there while we're passing out this Book of Mormon timeline, here, I testify, Ezra Taft Benson, it went along with what you just said. I testify, well, first, oh, dang, I'm going to go back to three paragraphs before. The point I was going to make is in one paragraph, but I'm going to do the preface to it because, golly, it's good words. I testify that wickedness is rapidly expanding in every segment of our society, is more highly organized, more cleverly disguised, and more powerfully promoted than ever before. Secret combinations lusting for power, gain, and glory are flourishing. A secret combination that seeks to overthrow the freedom of all lands, nations, and countries is increasing its evil influence and control over America and the entire world. I testify that the church and kingdom of God is increasing in strength, its numbers are growing, and as is the faithfulness of its faithful members, it has never been better organized or equipped to perform its divine mission. I testify, now this is the part I'm getting to where you just were, that as the forces of evil increase under Lucifer's leadership, and as the forces of good increase under the leadership of Jesus Christ, there will be growing battles between the two until the final confrontation. As the issues become clearer and more obvious, all mankind will eventually be required to align themselves either for the kingdom of God or for the kingdom of the devil. As these conflicts rage either secretly or openly, the righteous will be tested. God's wrath will soon shake the nations of the earth and will be poured out on the wicked without measure. But God will provide strength for the righteous and the means of escape, and eventually and finally truth will triumph. And he goes on to talk, and there's several more paragraphs I'd love to read to you, but in the interest of time, we need to know that there will be a division. The tares and the wheats will be separated. And I really believe that we're given time right now for us to grow together, and I just pray that I'm one of the wheat that somehow might have some value to the Lord in this long-term value in the kingdom. But, yes. That was out of I Testify. That was his final testimony to the church. No. That was Ezra Taft Benson. And when a prophet gets up to the pulpit and he hits, every paragraph starts with I testify, until he gets down to one that says, I solemnly testify. I mean, it's kind of like, whoa, listen up. We can go home now and review this until we got our act together. Okay, yes. Well, that one was out of the Ends line, and I closed the... Yes. It'll be on the church website, but I've got the collection of all of the things he said while he was a prophet. Yeah. Oh, it was something that was put together a number of years ago when he was the prophet. So, the whole little booklet? Yeah, that's just, you just take all the things and you copy them out and you put them together and bind them. Okay. You've got a little timeline of the Book of Mormon, and I don't know when we really ought to stop, because you guys might just get, we're so diverted from where I was going to this to begin with that I may not even able to deliver the full message. But anyway, nonetheless, maybe it was edifying for us all to be together tonight. This little talk that I'm going to just briefly review of Ezra Taft Benson's, a friend of mine keeps track of things like this, and he tells me that he has counted 26 times Ezra Taft Benson gave this talk during the time he was an apostle or the prophet. 26 times. Now, they only have so much face time with you. And if he really gave it 26 times, you'd think, you know what, maybe he wanted us to get the message. Okay, it's called The Book of Mormon is the Word of God. And by the way, there was a little book published. In fact, do I have it here? Maybe I didn't bring it. A Witness and a Warning is the name of the book. It was 11 talks given by Ezra Taft Benson as the prophet about the Book of Mormon. Now, he gave 9 talks during that same period of time on the Constitution. 11 on the Book of Mormon, 9 on the Constitution. And it's interesting to me how the Constitution was often referred to in the Book of Mormon talks. But anyway, in this one talk that he gave 26 times from the time he became an apostle until he became the, and through the time he gave the prophet, and this was given as he was the prophet, he says, the Book of Mormon brings men to Christ through two basic means. First, it tells a plain manner, in a plain manner, of Christ and his gospel. It testifies of his divinity and of the necessity of a redeemer and the need of our putting trust in him. It bears witness of the fall and the atonement and the first principles of the gospel, including our need of a broken heart and a contrite spirit and a spiritual rebirth. It proclaims we must endure to the end in righteousness and live the mortal life of a saint. Okay, so that's point number one. That's a lot to me. And here's something we never, ever, ever hear. The second point. The Book of Mormon exposes the enemies of Christ. It exposes the enemy. What are you talking about? He goes on to say, it confounds false doctrines and lays down contention. It fortifies the humble followers of Christ against the evil designs, strategies, and doctrines of the devil in our day. The type of apostates in the Book of Mormon are similar to the type we have today. God, in his infinite foreknowledge, so molded the Book of Mormon that we might see the error and know how to combat false educational, political, religious, and philosophical concepts of our time. And then he goes on in here. I'm going to have to skip up ahead a little bit because I know you'd love to hear the whole thing. But now we have not been using the Book of Mormon as we should. Our homes are not as strong unless we are using it to bring our children to Christ. Our families may be corrupted by worldly trends and teachings unless we know how to use the book to expose and combat the falsehoods in socialism, organic evolution, rationalism, humanism, etc. By the way, I talked on humanism a couple weeks ago on the radio. Our missionaries are not as effective unless they are hissing forth with it. Social, ethical, cultural, or educational converts will not survive under the heat of the day unless their taproots go down to the fullness of the gospel which the Book of Mormon contains. Our church classes are not as spirit-filled unless we hold it up as a standard. And our nation will continue to degenerate unless we read and heed the words of the God of this land, Jesus Christ, and quit building up and upholding the secret combinations which the Book of Mormon tells us proved the downfall of both previous American civilizations. Whoa, where did that come from? I mean, this was pretty powerful stuff. Let me just jump over to another talk that he gave. It was called The Book of Mormon, Keystone of Our Religion. Well, let's see. Unless I lost the, I had it earmarked here. Well, this is called The Book of Mormon is the Word of God. And by the way, what was published in the Ensign had removed this thing about socialism and organic evolution. This is the pre-published version of it. So it's kind of a, it's like, whoa, what happened? Anyway, The Book of Mormon, Keystone of Our Religion. And he talks about you know, first, the Book of Mormon is the keystone of our religion. We can get closer to God and all that kind of stuff. And then he goes in, second reason for we must make the Book of Mormon the center of our study focus is that it was written for our day. And then he goes on to talk about, I'll just read you about a paragraph and a half on that. The Nephites never had the book. Neither did the Lamanites of the ancient times. It was meant for us. Mormon wrote near the end of the Nephite civilization. Under the inspiration of God, who sees all things from the beginning, he abridged the centuries of records, choosing the theories, speeches, and events that would most be helpful to us. Each of the major writers in the Book of Mormon testified that he wrote for the future generation. I'm skipping down here. Moroni said, "Behold, I speak unto you as if you were present, and yet you're not. But behold, Jesus Christ hath shown you unto me. If they saw our day and chose those things which would be of greatest worth to us, is not that how we should study the Book of Mormon? We should constantly ask ourselves, why did the Lord inspire Mormon or Moroni or Alma to include that in his record? What lesson can I learn that will help me live in this day and age?" And there is example after example of how that question will be answered. For example, in the Book of Mormon, we find a pattern for preparing for the second coming. A major portion of the book centers on the few decades just prior to Christ coming to America. By careful study of that time, we can determine why some were destroyed in the terrible judgments that preceded his coming and what brought others to stand at the temple in the land of Bountiful and thrust their hands into the wounds of his hands and feet. From the Book of Mormon, we learn how the disciples of Christ live in the times of war. From the Book of Mormon, we see the evils of secret combinations portrayed in graphic and chilling reality. In the Book of Mormon, we find lessons dealing with persecution, apostasy, etc., etc., etc. He goes on to materialism and everything like that. That's in November 1986, Ensign, so it was given October Conference 1986. Okay, so when I read that, I thought, Book of Mormon, keystone of our religion. I thought, my gracious, maybe there's another way to look at the Book of Mormon. So I was up camping and I put this little timeline together that might be of some worth to you. I don't know. It was written for our day by prophets who saw our day and knew our needs. That's kind of at the heading of it. And I start with about 2200 BC. We don't know exactly when the Jaredites came from the Tower of Babel, but that's the best I could come up with. And each one of the top segments is labeled one with a circle around it, two with a circle around, three and four. The first segment, the Jaredite period, was about 1,500 years and covered in only 31 pages. Okay, and you can read down below that. It says segment one was 57% of the years in the Book of Mormon was in segment one, and yet it was only 5.84% of the whole book. And so there was 48 plus years per page. Okay, so you're getting the idea of how this is laid out. The timeline is showing the relative lengths of time in each period that I have broken these out to. Well, look at segment three. Let's go to segment two first. It's 600 BC, they leave Jerusalem, Nephi and his family and Lehi and everybody comes across. It's 208 years and covered in 204 pages. But we come to segment three. And I started segment three in the 29th chapter of Mosiah, when the Constitutional Republic was established for the Nephites. And it's the time that runs up to the birth of Christ through Christ's mortal ministry and the destruction of the government, the Constitutional Republic that was established. So basically that segment number three covers the period of time that the Nephites had a Constitutional Republic like we have today. Okay? And look at that, it's only 121 years, but it's 216 pages. Why? Why? Well, isn't that the period we're in? We're in a period of time when we have a constitutional republic, and we're making a run-up to the Savior coming to earth. And these Nephites, that were the prophets at the time, that saw us, and we can go back and prove this, I think, that they saw our day, and they says, they're going to need this. Oh, they're going to need this. Okay, and I suspect, and this is my philosophy, and you don't have to take it. No prophet said this, I guess, so that you can take this for what it's worth. But it's something, it's food for thought. If we're living in that same period of time that the Nephites lived in just before the Savior came, how did some get to go and thrust their hands into his side and feel the prints of the nails in his hands and in his feet when he came. Well, they did, but you know what? We have that same opportunity. How can I, and I have to say to myself, how can I be there instead of be destroyed in the great challenges that are going to come before, anyway, the Savior's return? How do I live through all the challenges that are coming? How can I be there when he returns? And a lot of those secrets, I think, are found in the Book of Mormon, that little segment that is the bulk of the Book of Mormon in comparison to the number of years it really covers. And I think that we need to kind of give some consideration to that. It's interesting to me that in that 1,500 years that is the Jaredite time, a great portion of that was focused on secret combinations, okay, and false government, okay? And as I down here, based on verse count, I've got to the kind of on the right towards the bottom. It says Book of Mormon top themes based upon verse count. The Savior is the number one theme. The Savior's mission and all that kind of stuff. Warfare is the number two theme. Missionary works, the number three theme. And secret combinations is the number four theme in the Book of Mormon. And if it was written for our day, I guess you have to say, wow, how does that apply? Isn't that kind of cool? Yes, ma'am. I think your thoughts are absolutely right on. I think that it's something that we each need to contemplate within our own hearts. Do I have to learn by sad experience, or can I learn by the experience of others? Can I develop faith by approaching God before times get bad? In this little thing here, in fact, maybe we can start distributing this. I hate to keep you too much longer. It's nearly 9 o'clock, and you may want to visit after. But this is the Constitution of Heavenly Banner. But this is the last couple of paragraphs in the Constitution of Heavenly Banner. You want to get a few more? Here's some more. If you run out, let me... This is Ezra Taft Benson speaking. We, the blessed beneficiaries, likewise face difficult days in this beloved land, a land which is choice above all other lands. It may also cost us blood before we are through. It is my conviction, however, that when the Lord comes, the stars and stripes will be soaring on the breeze over this people. May it be so, and may God give us the faith and the courage exhibited by those patriots who pledged their lives and their fortunes that we might be free. Now, he says that the stars and stripes will be floating in the breeze. They fly every day at my house. Maybe they fly every day at your house. There may not be a lot of people that are holding them up, but I plan to be among those that are. I think, and I have, yes, sir, back in the back. You know, we're going to have to end here in a while, I know. And I'll talk about this. Maybe we can use it as the closing remarks. Maybe not closing. We may, you know, just want to tie the loose ends up. I don't know how we'll quite do it because there's so many loose ends. But if you come up and look at the books that are here, this is a small sampling, by the way, of documentation that you could go to and understand what the prophets have said. I mean, there's stuff in the teachings of Ezra Taft Benson, for example, about the United Nations, which is also found in chapter 14 of An Enemy Hath Done This. The title, by the way, of that chapter on the United Nations is The United Nations Planned Tyranny. And it goes downhill from there, by the way. Stand Fast by Our Constitution is also not in print anymore. This hardback copy I've got right here, signed by J. Reuben Clark's daughters. So no, please don't take that one. But, I mean, these things that we have are just a small smattering of things that will help us understand what our duty is. This idea of preemptive war is an abominable perception of, in my opinion, abominable perception of justice. We have not, and we do not have, the right to go out and wage war. And since this is kind of an LDS, LDS meeting, at least that focus, I'm not going to go into the Founding Fathers' words on it. The Founding Fathers were direct and unequivocal in their statements about this issue of war. And we have polluted vastly, and we've gone beyond the wellspring, down through the pastures, and we're well beyond the corrals now in that stuff. But just from an LDS perspective, if you want to write down a few scriptures, and I'm probably not going to have time to go through all of them, but Doctrine and Covenants, section 98. By the way, that's the one we talked about, that the Constitution, whatsoever is more or less than this, cometh of evil. Let's just look at it. Well, let's not look at it right now. I gave you constitutions. Look this up in a minute. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Congress shall have power to declare war. There is no other way that we can go to war. And if the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants is correct, whatsoever is more or less than this cometh of evil, we need to go back and say, well, what does it say about this subject then? Oh, by golly. It doesn't say the president has any authority to take us to war, preemptively or otherwise. That war must be declared by Congress or it is an unconstitutional war. End of discussion. Okay, so the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, we've already reviewed that enough. But in the 33rd verse of the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, and you can read several verses beyond this, but in the interest of time, I'll only read one. And again, this is the law that I gave unto mine ancients, that they should not go out unto battle against any nation, kindred, tongue, or people, save I, the Lord, commanded them. Okay? That's section 98, verse 33. And you can talk about the other things about how lifting a standard of peace and all that kind of stuff. We won't go into that. I'm going to give you a few other scriptures that you can use as references, and we'll maybe read a few of them. Some of these give justification for war. They say, here's why you go to war. And one of them is what was declared in the 46th chapter of Alma. We'll give you this in a second. When the title of liberty was raised, in memory of our God, our religion and freedom, our peace and our wives and our children. There are six reasons that we go to war to defend. Still has to be done constitutionally, because that's the charter of our land. You just don't preemptively say, golly, I think they're going to go after my kids. We better go out and slaughter them all. It has to go through the process in order to be legal. If they can violate, and I'm getting off in something I said I wouldn't do, but if the nation's leaders can violate the charter that they raised their arm to the square and before God and the whole nation, they took an oath that they would uphold. If they can violate it on something as momentous as war, and by the way, war is the ultimate obscenity. All other evils are outgrowth of it, or at least are magnified by it. War is institutionalized murder, and it's done by the millions in many instances. It is something that God... What's this stuff about thou shalt not kill? What's this stuff about, the Prince of Peace? Peace on earth, goodwill to all men. You know, I mean, all these things. Now, war happens. And in April conference of 1942, the United States was thrust into a war. It was a war declared constitutionally. And I've got the documentation up here, and we're not going to have time to read all my... I've got a file about that thick right here that I brought with me about LDS and war. Basically, I used to carry that when I was in the service. I carried it in my pocket right here, that talk, my fatigues. And basically, it was a reminder that if you're in the military, you're kind of powerless to resist the things that your government has thrust you into. And you will not be held accountable for those that you are caused to kill. But those that have fostered and carried out the war will be held accountable as warmongers. And what does the 76th section of the Doctrine and Covenants tell us about warmongers? They're thrust down to hell. So anyway, it was a little bit of a comfort if you have to go serve. But we as a people, somehow, some way, have got to bring some sanity to this. And we've got to say, you cannot, for any reason whatsoever, go to war unless it goes through all the hoops. And then we get to talk about the just war. But let me. So anyway, there's a number of these scriptures I'm going to give you, and we'll read a few of them. Sir? Well, I happen to agree with you, but let me just tell you what Joseph Smith said, just for the fun of it, okay? Hiram Smith, first of all, patriarch of the church, brother Joseph Smith, he was martyr for the kingdom. He said, "We engage in the election the same as in any other principle. You're to vote for good men, and if you do not do this, it is a sin. To vote for wicked men, it would be sin. Choose the good and refuse the evil. Men of false principles have preyed upon us like wolves upon helpless lambs. Damn the rod of tyranny and curse it. Let every man use his liberties according to the Constitution. Don't fear man or devil. Electioneer with all people, male and female, and exhort them to do the thing which is right. We want a president of the United States, not a party president, but a president of the whole people, for a party president disenfranchises the opposite party. Have a president who will maintain every man in his rights." That's out of the History of the Church, Volume 6, page 323. Okay, now there was a two-party system in 1844, much like there is today, in regards to the question as to whether to vote for the Whig candidate or the Democratic candidate, which was the two parties of the day. In the election of 1844 and his willingness to not vote for either, Joseph Smith said, quoting, "We shall have the satisfaction of knowing that we have acted conscientiously and have used our best judgment, and if we have to throw away our votes, we had better do so upon a worthy rather than an unworthy individual who might make use of the weapon we put in his hand to destroy us." It's funny, these prophets hit on these things pretty hard, didn't they? That was in Comprehensive History of the Church, Volume 2, pages 208 and 209. Yes, sir. It's absolutely a correct principle, and many people say, "By golly, you're throwing your vote away." Well, I've voted for Ezra Taft Benson in a couple of elections when he was the prophet. I got to tell you, he was a write-in. But by the way, he ran for president before many of you were born, but didn't go very far, even among the saints. You had a comment back there too, Mark. That was June of 1976, Message of the First Presidency, The False Gods We Worship, and it's got to be one of my favorite all-time messages of the First Presidency, and he goes on to note Enoch's experience and Jehoshaphat's experience and the defense of their people based upon their faith. And I wish we had time to really go into that a lot more, because you're absolutely correct. Yes, sir. And I'll give you the references on that in just a second. So we can maybe give you some of these. Go ahead. Okay. Yeah, Hiram and Joseph. Let me get back to them. I mean, I'm sorry to be so dysfunctional when it comes to my ability to keep all these things sorted while we're throwing them around up here. The Hiram Smith one was History of the Church, Volume 6, page 323. And then the Joseph Smith one was in Times and Seasons, but you probably don't have access to that. So let's go in B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History of the Church, Volume 2, pages 208 and 209. So anyway, let me give you the references. I brought that False Gods We Worship talk because it's one of my favorites, and was going to spend more time talking about that too, because it really is. We create gods of stone and steel, and we train a man to kill and call him a patriot, and we fail to look to God. And it's an indictment on society. That whole talk, by the way, is just a great talk. It's written like today's news today. Boy, where to begin? I'll give you several references, then we'll go look at a couple, two or three of them. Let's look at Alma chapter 40. Well, let's not look at it, but I'll just give you these. Alma 43, 29 and 30, and 45 through 47. Alma 46 and 12. Okay, Alma 43, 29 and 30, and 45 through 47. These are ones that tell us why we go to war. Alma 46 and 12, of course, that's the title of Liberty. Alma 48, 14 through 15. 3 Nephi, chapter 2, verse 12. 3 Nephi, chapter 3. Go ahead. Going too fast? 3 Nephi, chapter 2, chapter 2, verse 12. 3 Nephi, chapter 3, 20 and 21. Then, say again? It does hit it right on the head, doesn't it? Well, and here's the next three I'm going to give you are going to give you the actual result of it to the Nephites. Mormon chapter 3, 10, 14 and 15. Mormon chapter 4, okay. Okay, the one before that was Mormon chapter 3, verses 10, 14 and 15. And Mormon chapter 4, verses 4 and 18. And then an indictment to say we got to bury our weapons, Mormon chapter 7, verse 4. So anyway, having said the one that back in the 98th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, let's look at the 3 Nephi one first that you like so much. This was a condition where they had bad guys that were threatening them. And I'm going to read verse 19 first. because this is when Lycaonius and Get Good On I were there. And it says, beginning in verse 19, now, this is Third Nephi chapter 3, verses 19, 20, and 21. Now it was the custom among all the Nephites to appoint for their chief captains, save it were in their times of wickedness, someone that had the spirit of revelation and also prophecy. Therefore, this Gidgadoni was a great prophet among them, as also was the chief judge. Now the people said unto Gidgadoni, pray unto the Lord, and let us go up upon the mountains and into the wilderness, that we may fall upon the robbers and destroy them in their own lands. But Gidgadoni saith unto them, the Lord forbid. For if we should go up against them, the Lord would deliver us into their hands. Therefore we will prepare ourselves in the center of our lands, and we will gather all our armies together, and we will not go against them, but will wait until they shall come against us. Therefore, as the Lord liveth, if we do this, he will deliver them into our hands. Now, think about this for just a second. Where are all the armies of the United States right now? There's more than 130 countries that we're in. And so there are none. Well, not none. There's a few here. They're depot level maintenance guys and stuff like that. But we have a very small contingent that are left here in the States. What would happen if we actually applied the Book of Mormon to our time and said, we will gather together in our land. We will close our borders is basically what the Nephites said they were going to do. And we'll starve them out. Now, trust me, if that happened today, the economic influence that the United States trade has around the world would have everybody saying, please, can't we be your friends? We'd like to deal with you some more. Couldn't we do some business with you? You know, we'll make sure that we've eradicated these Gadianton robbers that are out there, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that was the advice when the Nephites, had faithful leaders. Okay? That they had chosen, that had the gift of prophecy. Yes, sir. Okay, but did they ever go about it constitutionally? I mean, they did not. And what did they do with the Patriot Act and everything else? They basically are undermining and destroying the sovereignty of the American individual people. Yes, ma'am, over here, and then we'll go over here. They were. You're absolutely correct. Our troops were all over the world to begin with, and now they're even more so. And we've made enough enemies over there to make darn good and sure that they keep trying to come into our country through any border that we have left porous. You know, these individuals that come in are not all so-called poor people looking for to better their lives, but many of them are carrying very nefarious plans in their back pockets. You had a comment. Not only that, it wasn't even published. You couldn't read it if you wanted to. And so the Patriot Act, onerous as everything else is, as the whole thing is, there were 16 elements that could be sunsetted, and were supposed to be. But as you point out, there was one senator left that basically extended it until the 3rd of February. Okay. Well, certainly it is, but do we mind about those things anymore? Okay, anyway, let's go over to see the fruits of them taking the war to the people. Let's go over to Mormon chapter 3. We don't have time to read all of these, but you guys can read them when you get home. Mormon chapter 3, verse 10. It says, and they did swear by the heavens and also by the throne of God that they would go up to battle against their enemies and would cut them off from the face of the land. This is when Mormon was having so much trouble trying to lead this people that were so rebellious. And you jump down to 14. And when they had sworn by all that had been forbidden them by our Lord and our Savior Jesus Christ, that they would go up unto their enemies to battle and avenge themselves of the blood of their brethren. Behold, the voice of the Lord came unto me, saying, vengeance is mine, and I will repay. And because this people repented not after I had delivered them, behold, they shall be cut off from the face of the earth. Okay? Now let's go over to chapter 4, and let's see how this actually carried out. Verse 4. And it was because the armies of the Nephites went up unto the Lamanites that they began to be smitten, for were it not for that, the Lamanites could have had no power over them. And then down to verse 18, and from this time forth, did the Nephites gain no power over the Lamanites, but began to be swept off by them, even as a dew before the sun. And so anyway, I mean, there's much other evidence that we can go to that the Lord had a plan for war. Yes. A couple other paths we could follow on this. I talked to you about the April Conference of 1942, that you can probably find that on the church, some database anyway. And there was, yes, sir. Well, the people rebelled, and they turned their back, and they were in open rebellion, there's no question. I think it's related. And let me just give you one other quick thing, and then we ought to end. It's well after 9, and you got to have the doors closed up on you pretty quick here. And maybe I haven't even begun to fulfill what you had wanted to have done here. When I, like I say, this kind of took on a life of its own. But in recent days, there has been a lot of press about how thinly spread the United States military forces are. Duh. How can we do this with 130 nations we've got to have a presence in? And where we've got this quagmire that we're involved in Iraq, and I wish there was time, because then there really isn't germane to the subject tonight because of the fact that it's not really exactly LDS related. But if you knew the history of Iraq and what went on since the early days, certainly the early years of World War I, and the British involvement there, and the quagmire that they were involved in, the weapons of mass destruction that were used by the British forces against the Iraqi people, and particularly the Kurds, the things that Saddam has been accused of, and was probably guilty of, by the way. The British were the first ones to use weapons of mass destruction against the Iraqi people. And when we... Yes, sir? He certainly did, and so did Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, and I mean, you know, we can name a lot of good guys about them. In regards to which? Okay, I don't know the exact quote on that one there, but I do know he warned us against these alliances with others and everything. So it's probably there. I don't know. Well, talk to me after. I'd like to look that up and have that in my files. Where were we? Iraq. Oh, yeah. What's that? The British forces in Iraq were there, and they were in a quagmire, tens of thousands of casualties over many, many years. They were not able really to extract themselves from that until the 1950s. They kind of got out in the 30s, but they continued with the presence until the 50s. But it didn't stop the issues from going on. The Bosnian conflict was going on 600 years before the Constitution was signed. It went on for 200 more years, and then we got involved. Okay? There's just time after time we can talk about these things and why we're spread thin. That's where I was going with this. We keep committing ourselves. Our blood, our fortune, and our sacred honor is being committed around the world. Unconstitutionally, not by a constitutional method of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. And we continue to do it and put up with it. In the news recently, the last few days, there has been a lot of comment about how thin our troops are. I fear lest there will become, again, a motivation to institute conscription. In December of 1945, and I'm coming back to the church thing, the first presidency put out a statement in regards to universal conscription. They put out 17 points, cogent, well thought out, logical, true points as to why this would be a bad thing. And it applies magnitudes beyond this if we start to involve women in this, which is where they're going with this. Last year they voted down a universal conscription law that would have had every woman would have to have served also, regardless of marital status or children. And it's a despicable kind of thing. But you ought to try and get that. I didn't make you copies of it. I should have. Maybe I didn't think we were going to go this far into it. But in 1945, December of 1945, the church put out this 17-point. It's in Messages of the First Presidency. It's also in pamphlet form that they put out and sent out. But they were very, very concerned that Truman was attempting to instill universal conscription for all young men. And it applies so good today. I did a radio program on this a couple of years ago, or a year and a half, or something like that. But a lot of people didn't probably hear it. So there have been things said about almost everything you could want to talk about how our mission of the church is to proclaim peace and to bring the message of the Savior and so on and so forth. But when we are called, we have to go because we're powerless to resist the government. But that doesn't mean that some of us that aren't in a position of responsibility can't be working towards proper principles being fostered by the nation. Well, I don't know. What else? I mean, I'm going to talk you guys into the ground. Yes, sir. Isn't that concerning that we're kind of, you know, a prophet? Was he a prophet? I think he was, wasn't he? I mean, didn't he have these insights and didn't he give us warnings? It's terrifying to think that we've been so foolish in this. Anyway, let's go ahead. Well, let's see. I think that it's going to take really the return of the Savior to save it. I truly believe that. Go ahead. You know, I don't know exactly how it's going to shake out. And I'll tell you how confused I was about this at one point in my life. You know, we read in the scriptures about the great battles of the Middle East. You know, the 100 million men being battling together in the valley in Israel. And it's like, 100 million men? What? That's a lot of guys. You know, where'd they all come from? I mean, what's the deal here? And I always thought, when I was young, that somehow the United States would have kind of kept itself pure in that whole thing. I was so naive as a youngster that I thought, you know what, we've really got the proper government. It was established by our founders. We've got these oceans around us and everything like that. And I was so wrong, because we're right in the middle of it. We're some of the ones that are stirring the pot and adding fuel to the fire and causing so many difficulties that I suspect that many of the young men that come out of the families that are here might somehow be gathered in that. I don't know. It's a very challenging, difficult, horrible thing to think about. But I think I didn't bring this talk, but it's April of 1979. It was Bruce R. McConkie, Stand Independent. It was the name of the conference talk, and it talks about the atomic holocaust that surely shall be, and how there won't be any, you know, this shuttle diplomacy that'll solve the problems and everything like that. But he says in there very definitely, we have no promise. We have no promise unless we're faithful to the truths that we know. That's what we got to do. We got to hang in there faithful. And I think the Constitution will be saved in the hearts of people that can be reinstituted maybe after this cleansing thing. I don't know. Yes, sir. Just go here and then we'll go back over here. I'm sorry to have my back to you. Go back in the very back. You know, I wrote kind of a constitution for our family quite a number of years. You know, you would think somebody as strange as me would do something like that. But the family constitutions are being destroyed more than a thread at a time. They're being completely undermined by the vile things that are going on in the world today. And we need to gather our families to us and preserve them. And you're right, we need to save the family, and that's critical. Sir. You know, the problem with a lot of people that have passionate feelings about this is we are stubborn mules. You know that? We're very, very proud and independent people. We're Americans. We're the tribe of Ephraim, you know? And your point is well taken. It was mentioned when we first started that we have a little foundation called the Constitution Commemoration Foundation. And I'm willing to take advice, counsel, and assistance from any source and would be willing to go that way too. But what I find so often is, if they're involved, I'm not going to be involved. You know, if this and such group is there, I'm not going to be there. And if they're there, this guy's as dumb as a brick. I wouldn't do anything with him. You know, and pretty soon it's kind of like we're our own worst enemy. We really are. And what we need to do is recognize that this love we have of these principles needs to overcome some of our pride. And we need to say, you know what, this is bigger than me. And I'm learning these principles and as we go. I've spent a lifetime doing it, but, you know, it sure is cool to be able to share information with each other and figure out a way to approach it better. So maybe we ought to do something like that. Yes. I'll bet it'd be unanimous. Yeah. Is there anybody opposed? I guess I should say. Not even one, it doesn't appear. So somehow we've got to get our act together, it seems like. Yes.
Can you pass around a piece of paper that people can write their name, email, or whatever, and read afterwards?
We probably should have done that the first minute we were here, because we would have had 50 more people. And who gets this document?
You.
Me? I told you, I seek not for power, but to pull it down. I seek not for the honor of the world, but for the glory of my God and the freedom and welfare of my country. But I'm not looking for, but you know what? We've got to do as much as we can. You know, it may cost us blood ultimately, but we can maybe preclude that if we can do the right thing. Yes. What? A stubborn mule that's well, there's the John Birch Society and the Eagle Forum and the Concerned Women for America, and you can name a whole bunch of them. Constitution, certainly we wouldn't want to overlook that. Let's go here and then over there. You know, it's interesting, in Sunday school here a couple of 2 or 3 weeks ago, I got a chance to, you know, we talk about how beautiful are the feet upon the mount to declare peace, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And what does that mean? Well, you know, that I launched off on this thing in Sunday school class, and I got a chance to review President Kimball's message of the First Presidency. I'm doing it in my high priest group the 2 Sundays from now. And so, yeah, there are a few out there, and it's interesting, when we got done, the class was going, you know what, it's right. Let me tell you my email, though, because somebody, and I don't think he's still here. Oh, yes, he is. He wanted to know something about how we defeated fluoride in our community. And I said, oh, write to me on our website. Now, our website's broken right now for our foundation. I don't have enough money to keep it running with good website support. But our email address is Liberty 1787, that's the year the Constitution was signed, okay? Liberty 1787 at comcast.net. And we won't be able to answer everybody's emails, I'm sure, but if you got ideas you want to share, or maybe if there's something that we have that we can email to you that might be in electronic form, we'll be happy to do that. But Liberty 1787 at comcast.net. Or Constitution. We have somehow, there's a lot of people that think we're interested in any kind of flavor of government that comes along, and we're on a lot of mailing lists, and it's kind of like, oh my goodness, I don't have time to listen to your meanderings. And so those get deleted before anybody reads them. So put Skousen or Constitution Party, or I don't know, on the, yes, subject line. That'll be good. That'd be good. That's the truth. Well, I'm going to leave the books out for a few minutes so you can come and take titles off them. Please don't take the books, though, like I said. But thank you for being so patient. I'm sorry to be so long-winded. Thank you.
Especially for those last thoughts.
Well,
it's a verse, the same ones that I've read.
Well, that's the truth in the gospel, you know. Well, maybe I won't read it out loud, but God provided that in this land of liberty, our political allegiance shall not run to individuals, that is to government officials, no matter how great or how small they may be. Under his plan, our allegiance, and the only allegiance we owe as citizens or denizens of the United States, runs to our inspired Constitution, which God himself set up. So runs the oath of office to those who participate in government. Certain loyalty we do owe to the office of the man who holds, but even there we owe, just by reason of our citizenship, no loyalty to the man himself. In other countries, it is to the individual that allegiance runs. The principle of allegiance in the Constitution is basic to our freedom. It is one of the great principles that distinguishes this land of liberty from other countries. But you got to get this book.
I got it.
Okay, good.
I got it. take them if they're available, take them. I'd like to make sure if they'll read them, I'd like to make sure they get in the hands.
4 years ago, I found the beach copy, and then we've done this.
Good. Whoops, you just dropped one. Hi.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, the problem is there's so much, and we spend so little time on it.
That's why we would like to take classes.
Well, not everyone.
Oh, were you the one that called?
Oh,
okay. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's right. Okay. The what?
You can do about six classes more.
It's six classes on this subject alone, and then six on, because literally what we do with the young people is we'd take them, we'd take them right from the very before the nation was started and show them what different forms of government there had been through the ages, and then bring them through the pilgrims and all of the stuff that led up to the Revolutionary War, the founding of the nation, what's happened since that time, and it's a huge, huge task to try and educate the young people, but it's not really happening any other way. Nobody's doing it.
I find a lot of people are interested in the Constitution, but they aren't interested in being activists.
That's true. Well, you know, there's everybody has a role to play. I mean, there's some that are great genealogists and some that are great scoutmasters and stuff. But, you know, if we don't keep our liberty, we won't be able to do all those other things either. It's foundational. It really is. So we need to say, great, do your genealogy, do your temple work. And, of course, we try and do as much as we can, too. But if we don't have liberty... Liberty is the golden thread that runs throughout the gospel. I mean, it's what in Moses chapter 4, where Satan tried to destroy the liberty of man, the agency of man, is we got that beginning point, if we want to call it that. Of course, God has declared agency through all eternity. And I think if God rejected agency, all of his creations would unravel. I think that's the glue that holds it together. Because every element, every spirit, every creation, every thing that we don't even understand exists, trusts and loves God because he is so committed to their ability to choose. And they choose to follow him. But if he said, no, I'm not going to allow that anymore, well, and they'd go back and be whatever they were before, it'd be chaos. And so this is foundational, I think.
CFR, that's something you start talking to people about.
Helaman chapter 6, it shows conspiracies are generational.
Yeah. He still hasn't done it.
No.
They're still just talking about it, but at least people are starting to hear about it.
Well, the president wants to create a Canadian, United States, Mexico.
That's the deep part of it.
He's destroying
it.
Joseph Smith wanted that too, by the way, under the Constitution. He said if Canada and Mexico could join us under the Constitution, it would be wonderful. But do you think we're going to get them to join under the Constitution or some other socialist one-world government kind of thing? That's a concern. You had a comment or a question? On to who? I haven't. Team Law. Okay. Team. Just squish together Team Law, one word, not any spaces. Okay. I'm not. Yeah. The Monetary Fund. Well, what we've got to do is just assume. And you know, if you knew what the United Nations. What was the exact title? The United Nations Enabling Act. It basically says that if the Security Council says we go to war, we go to war. And the president uses that as his justification in every case. And if you looked at why we went into the Iraq war and the resolution that, quote-unquote, delegated to the president the congressional authority to go to war, they refer to the United Nations Security Council 36, 37 times. I don't remember exactly, but it's over three dozen times. And they're going, if you really want to push it clear back, it goes back to the United Nations Enabling Act, which was all happening at the same time as your 1944 International Monetary Fund, Bretton Woods. Hmm.